Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Say our name together with me one time, Los Angeles. We are! We are! We are! We all are!
Ooh, no doubt about that. Is that crushing your cranium? Disturb was recorded by Westwood One Mobile, Biff Dawes engineer, assisted by Doug Field, Phil Kneebone, and Jay Resnick. In-studio reduction by Steven, where's my frickin' bailout, Cosio? High Voltage is a presentation of Westwood One, written and reduced by Fred Lindgren. Executive Puff Daddy Pimp would be Norm Pattis. Listen, got any beefs, thoughts, random ramblings? Naked pictures of your girlfriend? Email them to www.highvoltage@gmail.com, all right? I'm Nick Carter, wishing you all the best for the holidays. Merry Christmas, Kwanzaa, and a happy Festivus for the rest of us. And most importantly, peace out, bitches!
101.1 WRIF at WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Jalene Jordan, my co-host. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Peter.
So, you weren't really a good girl all year, were you? So you didn't get much for Christmas. Same with me.
Actually, I got more than I deserved.
Really? Yeah. I had a great Christmas. Japanese food and a film.
Right. Yeah. I worked.
Oh, that's right.
How it is every year. 10 years and running.
I just read something that Christmas Day has really become almost 100% secular, and that any religious goings on are Christmas Eve.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So
right.
I missed all that. That sort of thing sort of seems like everything's out of control, doesn't it, on the political and economic
in the world?
Yeah.
Here at home? What do you mean?
Chaos in Gaza as Israel's strikes continue. Terrified, well, this goes on and on and on. Wait, what is up with Hamas? They're like, remember the Black Knight in Monty Python's In Search of the Holy Grail, when they like cut off all his arms?
Yeah,
and
sure.
He's like, come on. Well, why would Hamas pick a fight with Israel unless they have some like totally perverse strategy that it's going to send the whole region into chaos and that countries
right.
will, in, you know, Arab countries will invade Israel, which I'm sure they won't. So what could be their strategy? Why would they be sending over these rockets? And in the meantime, of course, Israel is armed to the teeth, courtesy of us, the U.S. taxpayer, and it's all being used. I don't get it. It's horrible what's going on, though.
Yeah, it is.
Of course, civilians getting chewed along with the so-called militants as well. On the economic front, here's another cheery note to begin our show. Hey, by the way, this is a phone-in talk show. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan are the hosts. You guess which one of the two I am. But you can call 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
We have email as well. Short comments are welcome. Some may be read on the air. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. If you are bashful or if the lines are filled, and I haven't even looked. I haven't got my little mousey out here to see where we are in our little thing. Oh, people are already calling. I wonder what they're going to call about. Somebody already wants to talk about the power companies. What is 413,000 people without power?
Without power, yeah.
And I just lost my DSL. Could that be as a result of that? I know a lot of cell phones are down.
It very well could be.
Yeah. Anyway, this cheery note, U.S. economy shrinks as the International Monetary Fund warns of Great Depression. Oh, that's sweet,
yeah,
isn't it?
Great Depression, not just a depression.
Great, with a capital G and a capital D. The U.S. economy shrank in the third quarter. We're ending the fourth quarter right now, according to official data, as the IMF's top economist warned of a second Great Depression offering no respite from relentless gloom ahead of Christmas. Well, this was from Tuesday the 23rd.
Well, nothing's changed since Tuesday.
Yeah, I don't know.
People are now expecting those credit card bills.
Yeah. Remember, I was saying last week that there's two economies. One is what we think of as sort of the ordinary economy, what we actually, us ordinary folks, are delusional about. We think that the economy really is about us working, getting paid, and spending money. Some people owning businesses and making a profit through what they sell. And we know there's a stock market, and we know extraordinary sums were made, great sums, in fact, and we're not really aware of all of that. They talk about these financial instruments that even when they explain them, I have no idea what the hell they're about.
So true.
I mean, you create wealth by providing goods and services, by producing goods and providing services. These people are essentially involved in this enormous crap game that has crapped out. We had all this great enthusiasm for the stock market. And remember George W. Bush, one of his many, many failed years? He wanted to privatize Social Security. So they think, oh, if I only had my money in the stock market rather than in this no return. I mean, totally misunderstanding the nature of Social Security, which isn't about you investing your money, but it's paying for your parents' Social Security. So, but he had this great idea. Of course, it was all about getting his friends in the financial industry that he wasn't regulating at all, more and more money. But they were going to have us invest our instead of going into Social Security funds, it would go into an investment fund.
That is just really, yeah. And now in light of everything that's going on right now, it's even more insane.
It is. And here, this is one of these little obscure articles that I find in the New York Times. Firm built on Madoff ties faces tough questions. Now, not too many people, unless this is your job, are going to say, well, there's an article I want to read. Well, they're talking about Bernard Madoff, the guy that made off with everyone's money, the $50 billion.
Yeah.
He was arrested 11 days ago, which was on December 22nd, in connection with a $50 billion Ponzi scheme, P-O-N-Z-I. That's essentially just a big scam. And this guy ran it for a long, long time, made billions of dollars for people, millions for individuals, billions total. But it all finally fell apart because it was this scheme rather than this investment on any.
He's making it look good on paper.
Yes, exactly. But here, let me get back to this. Since Madoff was arrested, the Fairfield Greenwich Group has portrayed itself as an unwitting victim of the fraud, the biggest of Mr. Madoff's many losers. Clients of Fairfield, a secret, let me say that word correctly. Clients of Fairfield, a secretive hedge fund advisory company based in Columbia. Man, I'm having trouble tonight.
And it's early.
Yeah, let me try again. Citizens of Fairfield, a secretive hedge fund advisory company based in Connecticut, right here in the United States, lost $7.3 billion to Mr. Madoff's fund. But for Fairfield, working with Mr. Madoff was hugely profitable. Internal documents from Fairfield show that the firm has taken more than $500 million, that's half a billion, in fees since 2003 alone.
My God.
From money it placed with Mr. Madoff. Nearly all of those fees went to a handful of Fairfield executives, including Walter M. Noel, and that's Fairfield's founder, who used the money to build a glamorous life, splitting his time between homes in New York, Connecticut, Florida, and the Caribbean. Or the Caribbean, if you prefer.
Whatever.
I don't know which is right. Or maybe either will do. of all this, and it's a long article, and this is just the first three paragraphs. Clients of Fairfield, a secretive hedge fund advisory company. I mean, what is this all about? I mean, this is what shows, you know, the evidence that this is nothing more than a racket. And let's see if I can find this. Oh, yeah. Right beneath this, and this was a few days later on Christmas, who is reading this other than me, right? Federal cases of stock fraud drop sharply. This is people yelling at the radio, Werby, get a life! I do this for you.
Yeah, you listen, do,
not
Peter.
Not for you, Jillian, but no. For our listeners.
Yes.
For our listeners. Federal officials.
Someone's got to.
Yeah, it's a talk about a dirty job. Federal officials are bringing far fewer prosecutions as a result of fraudulent stock schemes than they did 8 years ago. 8 years ago. What happened 8 years ago?
Ooh, GWB.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Bush took office.
Right.
Essentially, this racketeer. According to new data that raised further questions about whether the Bush administration has been too lax in policing Wall Street. I mean, they write here in the New York Times with such, I don't know what you call it, indirection or something. The guy's a racketeer. The government was a racket under Bush, and it still is. He's still the president. Legal and financial experts say that a loosening of enforcement measures, cutbacks in staffing at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and a shift in resources towards terrorism at the FBI have combined to make the federal government something of a paper tiger in investigating securities crimes. Hey, these people believe in what's called the free market. They don't believe in the really in the free market, but they say they do. At a time when the financial news is being dominated by the $50 billion Ponzi scheme that Bernard L. Madoff is accused of running, federal officials are on pace this year to bring the fewest prosecutions for securities fraud since at least 1991, according to the data. This is compiled by the Syracuse University Research Group using Justice Department figures. There were 133 prosecutions for securities fraud in the last 11 months of this fiscal year. That's down from 437 cases in 2000 and from a high of 513 in 2002, the second year of Bush's presidency. Mm-hmm. So it's dropped something, I can't even do the figures, 80%, 75%, something like that. This is when Wall Street scandals from Enron to WorldCom led to a crackdown on corporate crime. And then they go, okay, man, you know, we're stepping on too many toes that are given, too much to the Bush crime family. You know, it's funny. Our colleague Mike Malloy, a great talk show host, he made up that phrase, Bush crime family.
Oh, Bush Co.
Yeah.
Or Bush crime family.
Yeah, Bush Co. is mine.
It's yours. Okay. Yeah. Let me get it straight.
I think I stole it from a listener. Hey, if you'd like to call in the meantime, Peter Werby and Jillian Jordan at night call at 313-298-WRIF. At the SEC, that's the Securities Exchange Commission, agency investigations that led to Justice Department prosecutions for securities fraud dropped from 69 in 2000 to just 9 in 2007, a decline of 87%.
Wowie.
So, you know, folks, I think some of you took offense or even umbrage, whatever the hell that is, when I kept referring to Bush Co. I called it, you know, instead of like the Bush government, Bush Co., Bush Incorporated,
yep.
Or a racket masquerading as a government. And that's all it was. It was.
Are you taking offense now?
Yes. Let me see if I can quickly find... Where is that? This thing about marijuana prosecutions.
I think I missed that one.
Do you have that one?
I think I missed that one.
That would be perfect right now, although I can't find it in a very small group because of stuff on my console right here. Because, you know, there's tens of thousands of prosecutions for possession of marijuana.
Yes.
Right? People that want to change their consciousness by smoking flowers.
I know.
And again,
so bad.
In the meantime, George W. Bush sets the context for the collapse of the economy through this lax prosecution of his rich buddies. That's what it's all about. 313-298-WRIF. Well, I didn't get what I wanted for Christmas or even for the solstice is when my wife and I exchange presents.
Right. I do the same.
Because we're pagans.
Yes.
We are.
We are pagans. And proud of it.
Proud of it. Proud pagans.
We're total tree huggers.
Yes.
And we're not ashamed.
Well, this, the story that won't quit, that keeps on giving, the Bush having shoes thrown at him. Right?
Oh, yeah, in Iraq.
Yeah, and what's so funny about that is where was I? Where I saw a TV monitor, and it was going, they were showing it over and over and over.
You were in Royal Oak at that restaurant, were you, that you go to?
That was on Tuesday, but I've seen it since then.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Well, people can't get enough of it.
The maker of the shoes that an Iraqi journalist hurled at the U.S. President, George W. Bush, and we're really getting all the information here, has had to take on 100 extra staff to cope with a huge surge in demand for his footwear. Isn't this great? Now, this man lives in Turkey, and his name is Serkan Turk.
Yes.
He's head of
sales.
Baden Shoes, and he says, between the day of the incident and 1 p.m. today, we have received orders totaling 370,000 pairs.
Isn't that amazing?
I don't know how to order them, or I would...
The 11-ounce shoes?
Yeah, isn't that what I was going to say? How could he even get that much thrust on them? So it's what? It's 5.5 ounces a piece.
Yeah, they're very light little things.
Like I have...
Clunkers.
Yeah, now. I mean, come on. We got snow. We've got, Turk said orders had initially flooded in from Iraq, followed by other Middle Eastern countries, and finally from the rest of the world, including 19,000 pair from the United States. They were formerly called Model 271. The black polyurethane sold shoes have been renamed Bush shoes. Can he, maybe he should be cut in. He could do like endorsements.
Oh, you mean the shoe thrower?
Yeah.
Oh.
No. Bush.
Oh, yeah, he could.
Because he laughed it off, right?
I think he really honestly did laugh it off, too.
Yeah, he's Laura.
The guy has no shame.
Yeah, Laura said that while the president laughed it off when an Iraqi reporter threw his shoes at him, she was not amused.
I'm sure she wasn't, but the rest of the world was, Laura.
Yeah, the president deftly dodged the shoes and hold on here, and wasn't hit. She said the president laughed it off. He wasn't hurt. He's very quick. As you know, he's a natural athlete, and he ducked it. But on the other hand, it's an assault, and I think it should be treated that way. I think the people should think of it that way. But then she says, as bad as the incident is, in my view, it is a sign that Iraqis feel a lot freer to express themselves.
Oh, give me a break, Laura. You are brainwashed. She's hopeless.
Then the guy gets beat to a pulp, burned with a cigarette, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And let's see. The shoe thrower has become an issue in the Iraq election that's coming up on January 21st. It said the Zaidi case could help al-Maliki, the prime minister's popularity. He's kept a distance from it, but most people believe that Maliki.
Which one is it?
I don't know. It could be either one. I don't know. Maliki. What did you say?
Maliki. You said Maliki.
Maliki. The whole world's going to hell, and we're having fun.
That would be something
him.
In Hawaii,
Maliki.
Maybe.
How's Maliki? Al-Maliki.
That's fine.
Okay, it's Al-Maliki, yeah. Let's see. Many Iraqis believe Maliki will either move either for an official pardon or a muted sentence, which could prove to be a popular move ahead of the January 31st poll of the elections. Right. So, and also... It's not like Bush has no defenders. The two most influential women in Bush's White House, Laura Bush and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Remember, he one time had a slip of the tongue, one of his hundreds, and called her his wife.
Oh, yeah, yeah. secret lust for Condi, maybe.
Maybe secret.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. She says, I think generations pretty soon are going to start to thank this president for what he's done. Yeah.
All right. Don't hold your breath there.
Yeah. It really.
Lady.
The economy, the Great Depression, or at least the horrible recession we're facing, may have just moved the ball over the line so that he's right up there with Hoover and Nixon.
Oh, yeah.
He was a great Republican president in
sure
the 20th century. 21st century now, isn't it? All right. Oh, well, everybody wants to say something.
It's a chit chat. Let's do it.
313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And we will just go in order. Here's Mike in Birmingham. Mike, hi, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
Yeah. Say, guess who controls the power companies like Detroit Edison?
The Illuminati.
No, the Christian right. That's why if you turn against the Christian right, you will be dwelling in darkness.
What?
Well, what does it say, Mike? I have full power. Jolene has
power.
Full power. All right, thank you for that. The crews are working hard to restore power as we speak. Here is Greg. Greg's in Rochester. Greg, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Peter and Jolene. How are you?
We're
hey,
well.
Fine. Thank you.
Actually, it's Molokai. It's Greek.
It's not Greek.
Yes, it is.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
But anyway.
I was right. It's not Maliki.
Listen, we have any number of Arab American listeners. Could they call us, please? 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead. Go ahead.
But I was going to say, you know, this Israel thing?
Yeah.
With all the planes? Have you ever read the Left Behind series?
No, I've missed those. That's the one where it's about the, what do you call it? Everybody gets taken up and the sinners.
By aliens?
No, by the Invisible Man.
Oh,
no. What's that called?
A Left Behind series.
I know, no. But what's the process where the faithful get taken up to sit by God's feet? What a concept. And the rest of us sinners just are down here boiling in hell or whatever.
Exactly. But, you know,
what?
But you know what? It started out with Israel sending a whole lot of planes. They sent 80 planes over there to bomb the Palestinians.
Yeah. So you may think this is the acting out of these books.
Well, I don't know if it is or not.
I hope not.
You know what?
I hate to be here boiling and, you know, whatever.
No, I ain't boiling nothing.
No, I mean us, if that happened. You know, I can't. It was the name of a movie, too, Julian. It begins with an R. No?
Yeah, something like that.
Come on. What is it? Reform, Reformation, Resurrection.
The Left Behind Resurrection.
He's just going with the flow.
You're going with the flow. All right. Well, who knows? Prophecy may be realized in our age. People begin to think.
What are you talking about, Peter?
Who,
did you just say that?
What?
It may be realized in our age?
I was kind of being facetious.
Oh, good.
I don't think so. All right, thanks, Greg. But in times of economic strife that people...
the churches are filling up. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Caller called to tell you that there's a lot of pagans listening to you every Sunday.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Are they the ones that say, blessed be? I never say that.
I don't say that either. Yeah.
What are the... You know, well, there are some other people that are not exactly pagans, but it's sort of pagan-esque. This is the mega orgy that was planned for Tel Aviv.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We had our flights all scheduled. And
yeah. This is must be from some Hebrew site because it's called Culture. It's ynetnews.com. That apparently, after weeks of preparation for the largest sex event of its kind in Israel, I mean, they've had like others that were competing. Organizers were forced to cancel it this week due to public pressure and threats exerted on the owner of the venue where the sex fest was to take place. The event in question, which was scheduled to take place on International Orgasm Day, aimed to bring together some 250 participants seeking to provide world peace through multiple orgasms reached by masturbation or sex.
Wow.
The orgy was organized by the Raelian movement. I think that's how you say it. Raelian. It's a UFO religion whose followers believe humankind was created by aliens.
Oh,
later for that God stuff, right? It's aliens. The group spokesman, Kobe Drori, said that the orgy was meant to include straight gays, lesbians, bisexuals, all of them over 18, you know, pleased to know. He said the purpose of the event was to try and bring world peace through mass orgasm, this by experiencing consensual sex and natural uninterrupted pleasure. It was important to make love without feeling guilty or shy, he explained. He also protested that nowadays the words war, violence, and murder have become more legitimate than sex, orgasm, and pleasure.
Wow, this guy's into it, man.
We wanted to put into practice the saying, make love, not war.
Okay.
According to Drury, the orgy was just the first in a series of events dedicated to promoting the objective. On January 22nd, the movement will hold a conference on sexuality and masturbation with experts and writers in the field. Well, I mean, I think they mean in the field of.
Are they going to be doing it in the field?
Well, I mean, this is a step down from a huge orgy to a conference, but whatever. He also vowed that the cancellation of this year's orgy would not deter the Raelians from setting up another sex fest next year, which is coming soon. Next year, right? Just a couple more days. The Raelian movement has several hundred followers in Israel and some 70,000 members worldwide, said Drury. We don't believe in demons, ghosts, and gods. The group's primary goal is to inform humanity without attempting to persuade regarding scientific messages that deal with the origins of life on Earth. The second goal, I go for this one a little
this
more.
This is kind of bizarre.
The second goal is to expedite the establishment of a society based on the principles of nonviolence, solidarity, self-fulfillment, and pleasure. So everybody's going, well,
so that's pretty cool. I can dig it.
But here's where we're going to drop off a lot of people.
Right.
To establish one global currency, one global government.
Oh, no.
And harness science to the service of humanity and not against humanity.
Oh.
So a lot of people don't like that global government, global currency thing.
Yeah, I don't.
I don't know. I mean, it's so far.
You're still stuck on the first part.
Yes. 313-298-WRIF, Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on Night Call. And let's get Billy from Roseville on the air. Hi, Billy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Pete. Hello, Jalene.
Hello.
Just in my time sitting on the phone waiting to talk to you guys, in my own opinion, I realize that there are too many people in this world with too many opinions that conflict, and there definitely needs to be order. So, anyways, what I was curious is regarding our economic problems, our social problems, just with the way that things are going with our civilization as humans. You being a very intelligent person, well, in my opinion at least.
Well, thank you. Oh, are you talking to Peter? Sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just curious what you think that... I apologize for being too vague with this question. But
no, go ahead. I can give vague answers.
That's cool. So I was just curious, what's your forecast or foresight, if you will, on how you think
what the hell is going to happen, right?
Yeah, how it's pretty much going to play itself out within the next few years, and even taking into consideration.
Wait a minute. I can stop you right there. I have absolutely no idea. The whole idea. We start the show with talk about revolution and all that. I'm not even sure what that would mean anymore. I know that the great reforms that people were advocating for this society, they seem to be less and less possible. We're going to be lucky if we just don't go completely down the tubes. And I mean beyond a Great Depression, because you can always kind of put forth a worst-case scenario. And a worst-case scenario is way beyond a Great Depression. And what I mean by that is a total collapse of the institutions of this society, of the inability to provide food and heat and what we take as the basics of life. I'm not saying that's going to happen. Are you laughing?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well,
I have an answer for your big question.
All right, go ahead. Here, Jalene has an answer.
It's the rapture.
Oh, the rapture. That's right. Why couldn't I...
Bob wrote in, Happy New Year. It's the rapture, Peter.
Okay. Yeah. Listen, I knew it was an R.
So is the rapture part of your answer?
Who, me?
Yeah.
No. I don't think so. All right. So I think everything is really up for grabs. And the real problem right now is that we are just sort of stuck as these isolated, atomized individuals, hoping that the guys that ruined everything can make everything better. That's kind of scary, isn't it? I mean, maybe with Obama and these new people coming in, they can pull it out. But even they are saying, look, we're not going to be able to get this train back on track for a couple of years. And in the meantime, a lot of people are going to get hurt. And as I said last week, it's not the people that caused it. A few of them will. We've already seen some casualties among the ultra wealthy, but the people that are really taking it hard and getting hit the hardest and in the greatest numbers of now beginning to total into the millions are the people that did absolutely nothing wrong. They didn't do anything to contribute to the mess that we're in. Oh, you could say, oh, you know, they fell for the line about the mortgage, or they put too much on their credit card, or what have you. But that's all really emanating from the top. Those, if anything, those are just more victims. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. It's pretty dismal. Unless we can become, as happened so frequently in history, we can become the actors in history, that we're not just sitting hoping that things are going to get better. But here, oh, this is good. Here is Mohammed from Dearborn. Hi, hey. Mohammed.
Hey, Peter, Julian, how you guys doing?
Good.
Good, hi.
You know what, I have a feeling that one of these days I was going to jump in and chime in and help you guys out.
Okay. Please do.
The way you pronounce his last name is El-Maliki. Like, if you say it like straight up, like the way I would say it to my father, it's El-Maliki, but like, you know, El-Maliki.
Okay, El-Maliki.
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 And Mohammed, remind us what it means when you have A-L hyphen and Maliki.
A-L is, or E-L, or the way you pronounce it, E-L is just means the.
Oh. The, okay.
Yeah, the, sort of like Spanish, you know, like the L means the.
Yeah.
So El-Maliki, and I forgot exactly what it means. I think it's something like blessed from heaven, or heaven, or angel, or something like that, El-Maliki.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Well, I don't think that's what's happened to the Iraqi people with El-Maliki in there.
Not as of late. Anyway, yeah. Guys, I love your show, and take care and Happy New Year, guys.
Well, thank you. And Happy New Year to you, Mohammed, who's called our show any number of times before. Appreciate the language help with
that. We could use lessons any time with those types of things.
What do you mean, me? We. What do you mean, we, white girl?
Yeah, you're the one who called it Maliki.
I was just testing.
You're down there in Hawaii with Obama.
That's right. Hey, we're going to take a break. 313-298-WRIF. We actually have an open line for you if you'd like to talk about that. Ideas. What are we going to do? I mean, besides just put our head between our legs and kiss our ass goodbye.
I don't know.
I got a few suggestions. And also I want to tell you, I did get the figures about the marijuana prosecutions as compared to the securities fraud prosecutions, which has dropped off to almost nothing under Bush. So we'll be right back. You call. We'll be back to talk to you. 313-298-WRIF.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Hello, how are you?
What you missed from Mike in the Morning.
REO Speedwagon lead singer Kevin Cronin, who told a great story about a not-so-hot man.
She had her shirt off for like six songs. It's a very generous thing for any girl to do to a rock band. But
generous.
Then when she saw that we were kind of over her in that way, yeah, she took out her teeth and laid them on the stage. It was the grossest thing I've ever seen.
What a drag. Oh, that just sucks. What did you suppose the implications of that were?
Yeah, what do you think? I mean,
yeah, she thought you'd be like going,
this will be good. Yeah,
Mike in the Morning. No subscription necessary on 101 WRIF. Weekday nights at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play, the Mighty Metallica, with a big unit every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Hey guys, you know me. This is Carrie over at the New Pepper Bottoms. Do you know what you're doing this New Year's Eve? I do. I'm hanging out at the New Pepper Bottoms. Covers only $10, including dinner buffet. With the teeny toast at midnight. Enjoy our $3 wells, $5 domestic pitchers, and $5 bottoms all night. Ain't no party like a Pepper Bottom party. Did you hear me when I said covers only $10? Everything starts at 7. Be ready to party with DJ Crash spinning. Grab your free party favors at the door to ring in the New Year. With me, dress up like Baby New Year and get in free and win some of our awesome prizes. The New Pepper Bottoms in St. Clair Shores, 9.5 in Harbor.
The Black Keys. 101 WRIF presents The Black Keys with special guest Buffalo Killers and the Other Girls. January 29th at the Fillmore Detroit. Tickets available at the Fillmore box office and LiveNation.com. Plus, keep it locked for free tickets, band interviews, and more from your concert station. 101 WRIF.
The
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And joined by Jolene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. And we have some email?
We do, from Frank, who said, why do I get the feeling we Americans were put in the position we're in on purpose? And the people who put us here are getting off scot-free. While we are left to dig ourselves out as they run off into the woodwork, why aren't there criminal charges being handed out to the thugs responsible for the looting and the horrendous mess we're in?
And what about the war crimes? So now, actually, Vice President Cheney said in this interview that he signed off on waterboarding. This is an international war crime. Well, you know, slap the cuffs on the guy. Take him off to The Hague for the world court.
I saw a demonstration of that this week. I was just kind of looking around on the internet. It is horrifying.
Right. They always say simulate drowning. You're drowning. Yeah, yeah. And remember, that was how they were torturing people, like at Guantanamo. And there's been all sorts of people prosecuted, including Americans that were waterboarded prisoners in Vietnam and Japanese that waterboarded American prisoners during World War II, and U.S. soldiers that waterboarded Philippine prisoners during, when was like 1901 or what have you. By the way, Bob writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Actually, it was headed Happy New Year, which I think from a few times tonight. Jolene, we ought to wish everybody a very, very Happy New Year.
Oh, yes.
And, boy, usually that's just kind of like a greeting, right? Like, have a nice day or something like that. But we need a Happy New Year.
Yeah, 2009 has got to be better for all of us.
And Bob also reminded us that we were talking about the rapture is where I don't know what they call the people, the saved, I guess, get just, you know, like with a big magnet to get, and I think in
well,
these,
if it's so, I will not be going.
No. And, but sometimes, like, if it's like an airplane pilot.
Yeah.
He's gone, and the plane is still there, right?
Oh.
That's bad.
Hey, never thought about that.
There were a couple books, someone else. I mean, isn't this great that there is somebody that knows that knows anything we ask.
I mean,
this is like a Wikipedia audience.
It is. It's really great.
There were a couple of books written during like the 1940s, one where all the men disappeared and the whole world was left with just women, and another one, I think, that he wrote as well, where all the women disappeared.
I remember you talking about this before, but I can't remember the names of the book.
When all the women disappeared, I'm sure there were a lot of fights going on, you know?
When the women disappeared?
Yeah.
I don't know. Meow. We girls can be pretty catty when we want to be.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We were going to give you the figures here. This is why Obama really might decriminalize marijuana, which I don't think is going to happen at all. I mean, why would he start a fight at something like that? The article, which is in Esquire by John Richardson, talks about the fact that after Franklin Delano Roosevelt was in office for on the eighth day he was in, in 1933, when he began his term, that he said, I think this would be a good time for a beer. So prohibition was just ending, and that it immediately created hundreds of jobs, thousands of jobs, I guess.
Wow.
And soon the auto industry was tooling up for the first $12 million worth of delivery trucks, which, of course, was an enormous sum at that time. So what about marijuana? In July, Obama told Rolling Stone that he believed in, quote, shifting the paradigm to a public health approach. He said, I would start with nonviolent first-time drug offenders. The notion that we are imposing felonies on them or sending them to prison where they are getting advanced degrees in criminality instead of thinking about ways like drug courts that can get them back on track in their lives. It's expensive, it's counterproductive, and it doesn't make sense. That's what's happening now, he means.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, geez, well, wait, here are the statistics. 2007, the last year for which statistics are available, 782,000 Americans were arrested for marijuana-related crimes, 90% of them for possession.
Wow.
And we were talking earlier that under Bush, that the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, agency investigating securities fraud, had dropped from 69 in 2000 to 9. in 2007 under Bush, and that also, let's see, 133 prosecutions for security fraud in the first 11 months of this year, down from 513 cases in 2002.
What is wrong with this?
So the people that have destroyed our economic and social life, in some cases robbed us of our houses, our jobs, our pension, nothing's happening to them. And people that are smoking a little reefer, there's almost...
Leave them alone!
Yeah, 750,000 people. Now, in terms of jobs, as I've always said, what this is all about is creating clients for the prison industrial complex. I mean, whole towns are...
Meaning it's big business.
Yeah, whole towns have their economies, little cities have their economies based on local prisons for jobs and construction and what have you. In California, for instance, guess which two groups are the most, the opposing any marijuana reform? Well, the prison guards union.
Oh,
it's a union.
Because they need their jobs?
And there's, it's an enormous, is it the largest union in California? Someone tell us that as well. But, it's just part of the racket. It's just part of the racket. So we got to keep having Americans victimized for adults for their personal choice to alter their consciousness in non-threatening manner. In other words, we don't want them driving or anything like that. Remember what I used to say, war on drugs? Man, I can't even drive on drugs.
I don't know. I think most pot smokers would argue with that.
There was, I wonder if he's still listening. What's his name? I can't remember. MD. Well, do you remember? Were you ever, when he used to call, he would call up and always insist that he could drive better when he was drunk or stoned.
Oh, I remember that. Stone maybe, but not drunk.
Yeah, right. Let's see. Here is Luke. Luke is in Holly. Hi, Luke. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Julian. How are you guys doing tonight?
We're doing good.
Hi, Luke.
Oh, very good, very good. So you got an email not so long ago. I actually stole my thunder, but since it was on hold anyway, I'll let you know the word you were looking for is indeed rapture. And
that's
he's right.
it's a couple of pagans trying to figure this stuff out. You
right,
know?
Exactly. Well, it's a long-time listener, first-time caller, so I always said one day I'd chime in, and if nothing else, it'd be for a little vocabulary building. Yeah, got a great show.
Well, thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
Happy New Year
to
you. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. Here is Vern. Vern's in Roseville. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
I just want to talk to you about how the corporations are beating up on the unions.
They are. That's their strategy.
Okay, I'm just going to tell you my story is short and simple, and then you take it from there, okay?
Go ahead.
I was out in FMLA, which is a family, a medical act, where I don't get paid for 6 weeks up the time.
Right.
Like my mom was sick, okay, and she got in various accidents, and my brother, he was sick also, but they don't cover him, but they did cover my mom, so I was taking care of both of them. I went out 6 weeks, which I was entitled to, without pay, okay. I went over the due date by 3 days. My union steward told me, hey, you better come back to work, which I did. And my supervisor wanted to give me a day without pay, right?
Okay.
So now, Chrysler, Ford, GM, they let a bunch of people go. I work at Chrysler. But anyway, they let a bunch of people go. He's gone. I'm still there, fortunately for me. But still, I got all that stuff on my record because this guy wanted to put that on file because I was taking care of my mom,
Well, in countries like Sweden and Denmark, Finland, places like that, you get Norway, you get all sorts of paid leave time to take care of family emergencies. When you have a child, I forgot what it's up in the months that is paid leave. Because those people really care about their family. I mean, the government and the corporations don't, in this country don't give a damn. And all these politicians that talk about family values, they don't give a damn about families or our lives or anything. It's just lip service. But in countries that really care about its citizenry and don't have this massive military-industrial complex and a prison-industrial complex, have money to spend on us. Actually, it's the money we make. It's the money we create at work through the goods we produce and the services we provide. And instead of going into these rat holes of military spending and prison spending, it actually is funneled back in terms of what we need. So something like you're telling us, Vern, no one would ever have to tell in one of those countries.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, it's just amazing, and most of this country is blindsided. And I feel very fortunate that I have the job that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to see somebody go on an assembly line and, okay, if you're making $30 an hour, so what? Have you ever been there to do that job? It's a hard job.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole strategy, in particularly in periods like this, is to shave off, or in fact, and they're not even talking about shaving off now. They're talking, it's not a scalpel. They're talking about using a huge, axe to drive back the gains in wages and pensions and benefits that working people have made over the last 100 years or so. I mean, it's like we're getting sent back to go, to zero. And
the dark ages.
Yeah. All right, look, I will take it from here. Thank you very much for calling, and good luck on all this, and I'm glad you still have your job. There's actually too much of this article that I was thinking about reading. It's from Labor Notes. You can go to labornotes.org. It's also on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.
Peter? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I was going to give you a quick email.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, Winston Smith, our good friend, wrote in and said that he lost all hope that Obama might decriminalize marijuana when he chose Biden as his VP because Joe Biden is the worst drug warrior of them all, he says. It was he who instituted the concept of drug czar.
Yes.
It was he who authored and pushed through the minimum sentencing guidelines. Just think of some of the worst aspects of the war on drugs. And Biden has his hand on it.
Yeah, and also the guy that they're talking about. Let me see.
For drug czar?
For drug czar, yeah. Not good. Definitely not good.
None of them are that great.
No.
Alan
St. Pierre, who is the National Organization for Reform of Marijuana Laws executive director, says reformers will probably be disappointed that Obama is not going to go as far as they want, but we're probably not going to continue this mindless path of prohibition. I'm not so sure. I think, well, we'll see. So, I mean, we don't have to guess about this, but another member of the moneyed group, Marsha Rosenbaum, the former head of the San Francisco Office of the Drug Policy Alliance, quit last year to become a fundraiser for Obama and put together $204,000 for his campaign. And so she's hopeful. We shall see. I mean,
I met his cabinet in general.
Yeah, it's not, well.
It's not the greatest.
Yeah, it's pretty mainstream.
Yep.
I mean, why did people vote for him? Well, you know, I said this at the time. I was never really a big fan of voting for Obama,
right,
as much as I was voting against the hideous McCain and Palin ticket. Boy, she's
right
out of the news. Finally made a week where she didn't make some gaffe or someone in her extended family didn't get busted or something odd happened, right?
No, did we talk about this, or was that last week?
Her
daughter's mother-in-law-to-be got busted with all that OxyContin.
Yeah.
She made like 4 drug deals to undercover agents.
And she must have been doing it during the election campaign, right? It's not like she just started on November 5th.
Right. Duh.
Well, back to this article on Labor Notes, which I say is too long to read, and it has kind of a mild title, Faced with Concession Demands, Unions Search for Ways to Resist. And it talks about that at every turn, how companies now, well, even some of them that are very profitable, are trying to renegotiate their labor contracts to get people less reward for the work that they do. Because remember, it's all about distribution of income. And what people united into a union can do can often create a wage and benefit package way beyond what us as particular individuals can do. And that's why employers despise unions so much. I mean, you kind of take it for granted, and sometimes they have, like Starbucks, that just got, again, busted by the National Labor Relations Board for unfair labor practices, for firing union organizers from the industrial workers of the world.
Oh, wow.
You can go to IWW.org. And they say this ruins the Starbucks culture. Yeah, you gotta pay people a decent wage. That's what ruins the culture. It's the culture of the profits of the owners.
People are paying more for a cup of coffee at that place than someone's making in an hour.
Come on.
Really? If you get the most expensive one?
Nobody makes, there's not a $9 coffee, is there?
Is that what they make?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, it's close.
There goes your argument.
There
you
goes.
You were hoping I wouldn't bring that up.
I was hoping you wouldn't point that out.
Yeah. But one of the things that Labor Notes, I said, denied that it was on my website as well. I did. But that they talk about some of the ways in which that people can, and it's unfortunately not people, because individuals don't have any option. If your employer comes to you and say, we're cutting your wages by 10% or 20% or we're firing you.
Yeah, what are you going to do?
You can't do anything. If you are united with a union, well, then you can do it. And the momentum still isn't there like it was in the 1930s. Remember, the 1930s was the Great Depression. Yet people took it upon themselves to take extraordinary acts. I mean, for the previous 75 years, that people that tried to unionize had been shot down in the street. In fact, hundreds of people were shot down and killed during the 1930s. I know this probably isn't selling it to you as a process, right? But yeah. I don't think right now they just figure we're such patsies and we're such pushovers that they're not going to have to call out the National Guard and the strike breakers and the local cops and all that to shoot down in the streets the people that were demanding to be unionized. And anyway, now, because of the Roosevelt administration, that it's legal to do. There's not that it was illegal before that, but there's actual language that gives Americans the right to unionize. And you think, well, God, the employers would never stand for that. Or, well, you know, it's funny. When you've got a bunch of people that can speak their will as a united group, things change. And no one is suggesting, and no union has ever suggested, pay us a wage that will bankrupt the country or the company. And that's never happened. Because at any point where there was actually the willingness of a company to say, here's our books. In fact, that's what the UAW used to say all the time. The company would say, we can't afford the wage increase you're asking for, the benefits increase you're asking it for. And the UAW would say, open your books, show us, let us see.
Ah.
We're part of the process. You're saying you can't afford this. Well, obviously, if you can't afford it, if you really can't afford it, we don't want it because that would, hobble the enterprise. And, of course, none of them ever did, and that it just wound up, as it always is, a strike or an agreement. Or a strike, then an agreement. Well, the unions now are the only organized force in America that has the capacity and the commitment and the mission statement to defend those of us who are not organized. And I have to say, they're not all doing the best job in the world. They've crumpled in front of these demands for concessions, and you can see that in the UAW. We were talking about this last week, and the point was, or a couple weeks ago, and the point was made, if the UAW agreed to work for free, or had worked for free all that time that GM and Chrysler and even Ford were making bad decisions, that wouldn't have altered the situation that they wound up in. That labor's about 10% of it, and if you get concessions that drive wages, union wages, down to non-union wages, maybe then that it would be, the labor cost would be 9% of every automobile. The thing is, there has to be a national and universal health program paid for by the government. There has to be, maybe even taken over the pension functions. But it means we can't go on without really taxing the rich heavily. So people like, Carolyn Kennedy, who's worth $100 million. Why is one person worth $100 million? Dollars? Well, she worked for it. Oh, no, she didn't work for it.
She comes from rich stock.
Yeah, yeah. that we don't have this concentrated wealth, that it is commonwealth, that it used for the entirety of society. Well, you like class society, you like capitalism, okay, that's still in place, but the wealthy have hundreds of thousands rather than hundreds of millions or billions. And that you don't have this stagnation that's just based on this this accumulated wealth. That the only thing it has really is political and social and economic power of a few individuals over the rest of it. And we have seen that they cannot handle it. They have screwed everything up. I mean, it's one thing if you could say, these wealthy people are the stewards of our economy, and look what good they've done for us. Well, the opposite is true. They have screwed everything up. So let's relieve them of the, their capacity to do anything more. Let's just leave them with, I don't know, let's not be a real commie. What do we always say? Leave them with 3 or 4 million.
Yeah.
Instead of 3 or 4 billion or 35 billion or 100 million. I mean, Carolyn Kennedy, wouldn't she get along okay on just being worth like 5 million?
Probably not.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think so. I think she, you know, she goes to the south of France and gets yachts and...
You can do that on 5 million.
You think? All right.
Yeah, I could.
For the rest of her life?
Yeah. Well, I mean, let her get a job.
She's trying.
Yeah, she is. Actually, I think she blew it.
Oh, yeah. What was that all about?
She just didn't come off very well. Kept saying, you know. Who else
did
that?
She just needs Palin's people.
That was it.
Oh,
it was Palin.
It didn't work.
Yeah, right. Right. Ask her, what newspapers do you read? Right? Or what do you think about the Bush doctrine? I'll get back to you.
In what sense? What regard?
313-298-WRIF. Here's Kenny in Detroit. Hi, Kenny. It's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Hey, Peter. What's happening?
Nothing much. Doing the show with Jolene.
Dutch, it's pretty cool. I'm actually talking to you on the radio. I've been listening to you for like the last half hour or so and listening to the things that you guys are talking about. I heard you say something along the lines of what in the world are we going to do with this, our future and so forth.
Yeah.
I heard you mention something about the rapture and so forth. And I don't know, I think maybe I could offer a little bit of insight in that area. My background, I used to be a Baptist preacher. And now I'm currently a struggling rock star, and so I've kind of been on both extremes of the card, if you will.
Right.
Wow.
And I've been around the scene for a few years, and but I'd like to talk to you about a few things.
Well, go.
As far as like what we need to do. See, the first thing I think people need to realize is that there isn't going to be any one person, any one Superman, any one super politician, any group of people that's going to be able to wave their hand and all the problems are going to go away. All these things happen, all the things that we're dealing with from every scale, from every economic point of view, they're going to have to be dealt with in a eventual and gradual manner. Number one, people are going to have to realize it starts with them. It starts with me. It starts with you. It starts with everyone in your studio. Everyone within your listening audience needs to realize that things, we're living in a different world, and things aren't the same as they were even 10, 20 years ago.
Hey, Kenny, hold on one second. I actually have to do these commercials, just a few of them, before midnight. So let me put you on hold. I'm sorry. We'll get back to you in a minute. And also a line or two open at 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan will be right back with the second hour of Night Call after these.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Most WRIF contests are open to legal U.S. residents at least 18 years old. Winners may win only one contest every 30 days or every 6 months for prizes worth $600 or more. Employees and their family of Greater Media Detroit, its advertising agencies, and other radio stations in the metro area may not participate. No purchase necessary. Prizes are not transferable, and rules are subject to change at any time. Complete rules are available online at WRIF.com or at the WRIF studios during regular business hours.
Everything that rocks. All right, $9 million.
All of you who have stuck with me,
divided by 900,000 citizens,
through very difficult times.
$10 a head. Now you're not getting much more out of these guys.
I'm sorry.
Good thing you can still text message us at the RIF. Get your request, concert info, and your unfair cellular advantage. Text keyword WRIF to 71913. And
I'm sorry.
And we'll never be embarrassed to hear from you.
I would never quit on you.
Log on to WRIF.com for more details. 101 WRIF.
My phone blowing up.
The RIF.
What was that?
Oh, that? It's the sound of Motor City Steals and Deals, cutting prices on gift certificates to great Metro Detroit businesses.
I gotta see this.
The website is MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. They always have great deals, and every Monday they launch new ways to save. You can't beat it.
Have replacement automobile keys made by Aaron's Lock and Key. Get schooled at the Paul Green School of Rock. Save on fine jewelry at the Showroom of Elegance, or catch your favorite games at Art and Jake's. Start saving at half price or more.
Sign up for Motor City Steals and Deals email updates at WRIF.com.
My heart beats like crazy. My palms sweat. The vibrations become intense.
Katie Jensen is under the influence of Tom, her volunteer drum teacher.
Oh, that sounds great, Katie.
Spending one afternoon a month with neighborhood kids like Katie, Tom helps them stay away from drugs. Share a skill, a passion, a hobby with kids in your community, and you can make a big difference. That's because kids who enjoy a regular positive activity with an adult are less likely to begin using drugs or alcohol. Be a coach, a mentor, a volunteer. No matter what it is, you have something to offer.
All right, Katie, you rock.
Log on to helpyourcommunity.org or call 877-KIDS-313 and be an influence on the kids in your community. Brought to you by the Office of National Drug Control Policy and the Ad Council.
The Black Keys. 101 WRAF presents The Black Keys with special guest Buffalo Killers and The Other Girls. January 29th at the Fillmore Detroit. Tickets available at the Fillmore box office and LiveNation.com. Plus, keep it locked for free tickets, band interviews, and more from your concert station. 101 WRAF. HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRAF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Joined by Jalene Jordan. It's our second hour of Night Call. At 1 a.m., Rudy Simon will join me. He was part of a 14-person Detroit delegation to Iran organized by the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Talk about his travels throughout the country and his impressions of the people and the government. As in most of these places, and a lot of the trips that I've taken like that, love the people, don't like the government too much.
Right.
Don't like here.
Where, yeah.
We'll see if things are any different. All right, let me see. Woo, where's my screen? Oh, there it is. Okay,
We were talking to someone.
Kenny's gone.
Oh, Kenny.
Okay.
Call back.
Yeah. Let's see.
He thinks you blew him off, huh?
Yeah, I didn't. Here's Will in Royal Oak. Will, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
How you doing, Peter?
We're doing good.
So, a couple things. I've been listening to your show for about a half an hour now, and you've been talking about the fact that the labor unions are in so much trouble, and then the drug issue. To start with labor unions, if you look at the foreign automakers, most of the countries who manufacture foreign automobiles have some form of universal health care.
Right.
Now, Toyota pays about the same amount Ford does, and in fact, they pay more than GM does. But if you look, they don't have the legacy cost, which is hampering their well-being.
Right, the engineers. I mean, the guys that made the GM stockholders and all the other auto companies hundreds of millions and billions of dollars of profits over the years, right?
Right, right. What happens is these countries with universal health care cover the employees of these auto companies. So
Wait a second. I don't think that Toyota's employees are covered by Japanese health care. Is that what you're saying?
Japan has a form of supplemented universal health care.
Right.
It's not like England,
right,
where it's 100%, but they have a form of health care that does not require the employees to pay $15,000 a year to cover each employee, such as GM or Ford does here in America.
Right, but the domestic, U.S. domestic auto workers at the Honda or they're not covered by that.
No, correct. You're right. The domestic workers aren't. But if you look at the shape that Toyota and all their, and Toyota, Nissan, Lexus, all those companies, they do much better because they don't have to cover the healthcare costs that GM or Ford or Christ with you.
And by the way, too, all of those companies in their home countries of Japan and South Korea and Germany, they're all unionized. All the employees in the home countries are unionized.
Yeah, they're all unionized. And the reason they're not taking a haircut and they're not being yelled at by their Congress is because they're already covered. Their employees already have some form of protection. So the cost to the company isn't as high, and the cost to protect their workers' health and protect the company's profits at the same time is covered by a form of socialism through health care.
Yeah.
And it doesn't hurt the companies in these foreign countries. But we're so against giving everyone health care here in America, just a basic right to be healthy and have a doctor, to be seen by a doctor, that it seems like the Republicans in Congress rather kill a company than support, you know.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, they're for a kind of socialism, and that's what the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex is. It takes our tax dollars, it takes a portion of our salaries, and rather than giving it back to us in the form of universal health care or pension guarantee or the schools and roads and everything else that we need, it ships it off to these high-profit, capital-intensive industries that are, that prepare for war. So you got, you know, one plane costs $20 million or something like that. Doesn't make any sense. I agree with you. Thank you. Appreciate it. Here in a little bit of, I guess, religion news, Pope Benedict XVI spoke out last Monday against homosexual behavior, calling it a violation of the natural order. In an address to the Vatican hierarchy, the Pope called for an ecology of man, to protect man from the destruction of himself. No mention of
why women. Doesn't he just mind his own business?
Well, he is the steward of us all. He says the rainforests deserve our protection, but man as a creature indeed deserves no less. The Vatican opposes same-sex marriage and considers homosexual acts sinful. I wonder if he really realizes that pronouncements like this wind up in the kind of discrimination and violence against gay people that we see in so many countries.
Hmm. Yeah, well,
also,
he is so out of touch.
About this, one of the things that I think we have heard as a matter of course, that women that have had abortions suffer almost a post-traumatic stress disorder, that they get very depressed after having abortions, or it comes about years later, and they continue. And I've talked to people. I mean, I've talked to women on the air that that said, 20 years ago I had an abortion, and I'm so sorry that I ever did, and I just, every time I see a 20-year-old, I think that could have been my son or daughter, and there's this sort of remorse.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, maybe yes, maybe no. I mean, you could almost say that every time you have sex with contraception, right?
True. Not letting those babies be.
Yeah. But get this, no high-quality study done to date can document that having an abortion causes psychological distress or a post-abortion syndrome, and efforts to show that it does occur to be that it does occur appear to be, guess what, politically motivated, said U.S. researchers. A team at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore reviewed 21 studies involving more than 150,000 women and found the high-quality studies showed no significant differences in long-term mental health between women who choose to abort a pregnancy and others who don't. The best, Dr. Robert Blum, who led the study, published in the journal Contraception. Man, there's a magazine for everything. And he said, the best research does not support the existence of a post-abortion syndrome similar to post-traumatic stress disorder. He says, this is Vignetta Charles, who's a researcher. Based on the best available evidence, emotional harm should not be a factor in abortion policy. If the goal is to help women, program and policy decisions should not not distort science to advance political agendas. 1.29 million women last year had elective abortions. 129 million would be a lot. An estimated 25 million women globally have legal abortions every year. The article says abortion is a hot-button issue with many voters and members of U.S. Congress as well as state lawmakers seeking to ban it. Blum's team wrote, the research team, the U.S. Supreme Court, while noting that, quote, we find no reliable data to measure the phenomenon, cited adverse mental health outcomes for women as part of the rationale for limiting late-term abortions. Making this up to satisfy their own right-wing agenda or essentially right-wing male fantasies.
Oh, that's just so not surprising.
Of the obligatory, I am forgetting everything.
Compulsory?
The compulsory pregnancy movement. Why do they call these people pro-life? It's a compulsory pregnancy movement. They will take law, police, courts, prison to enforce women to have abortions.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. 313.
Don't even get me started, Peter.
I know. Got me started. 313-298-WRIF. Hey, we didn't even talk about movies. Did you finally see Milk?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, all right.
No.
I would highly, for an engaging film, for almost, in some ways, it's both. This is very compelling film about human beings in a struggle to overcome the stigma of society of homosexuality, and almost a documentary of the gay movement that was put together by Harvey Milk, who was a San Francisco supervisor, till he was assassinated by an angry white man.
That's right.
Yeah.
Who didn't like his sexuality. Maybe I'll go see that on New Year's Eve. Look at, there's a big old party.
You are going to get some. You keep behaving like this. You are going to get presents next year for Christmas.
I know.
Right.
I'm hoping.
313-298-WRIF. That's our phone number. And here's Alicia. Alicia, right?
Yes.
Alicia in Waterford. Hi, Alicia. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you? I actually want to, comment on a couple things from last week. You were talking about what is his name? Rick Warren.
Oh, Rick Warren, who has been chosen by President-elect Obama to give the invocation, even though he's made the most horrible remarks. He compared gay relationships to incest.
And pedophilia. Yeah, he's a real...
Yes.
Yeah.
I just want to make a comment on that. It was actually what you were saying last week, how he is a homophobic, but he says he loves gays. And the thing is, I don't know why people cannot see through him and Obama. That, they say, oh, we love you, we want your vote, but once the votes are in, the hell with you. Like, we're just being tolerated instead of considered.
So you think that it's all just political opportunism on Obama's part?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. There's a gay couple on my block, I haven't even dared broach the subject. I mean, these two guys were so enthusiastic for Obama. One guy had enormous signs all over his truck, and I keep wanting to say, so what do you think about this? There was a number, the phrase always used for Obama's choice of this evangelical preacher from California is a slap in the face. That's what they...
And even during the elections, during the final debates, every time that they were, asked questions about, homosexuals and rights and healthcare, they would somehow get themselves out of the corner without even giving an answer. And...
No, wait a minute. I think, Alicia, they were pretty explicit. All the candidates said that they absolutely opposed, without any equivocation, the right of gay people to marry. In fact, somebody made the point that Rick Warren and Barack Obama have an identical position on gay marriage. They both oppose it. That's what I keep saying all along, is that Barack Obama represented to many of us, particularly most of the voters that voted for him, everything good and decent, the end to what the Bush administration was all about. But he so far hasn't shown how much of this is embedded in him. When he starts talking about he's going to add 60,000 troops to the war in Afghanistan rather than that he might not be bringing the troops home from Iraq, why did people vote for him? They voted because they wanted an end to these wars. He talks about they might delay removing the tax cuts from the rich. That's another reason why people voted for him. But everybody saw him as that representing, in many ways, the best sentiment that all of us have. I mean, the people with the worst sentiments, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm sorry if this hurts anybody's feeling, I think voted for McCain. The people that represented the best sentiment of this country, the fairness and tolerance and justice and all of that, voted for Obama. But whether or not he's going to make those things real in the manner that we really want them, well, it's not January 20th, Les, yet, so maybe I should cut him a little slack.
And another thing also, you were talking about the last week, the declaration to decriminalize homosexuality in all countries.
Right, by the United Nations, that the United States lined up with all the Muslim countries to oppose.
Yes, well, I don't understand why every country but America is okay with this. And, you know, America of all nations.
Yeah, well, it's kind of hard for the United States to have all these states. Well, I don't know. Are there still law? I don't think they've...
There might be a couple left where the...
The Supreme Court, quite a while ago, ruled against the so-called sodomy laws.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I remember that.
So homosexual acts are not illegal any longer. So I don't know why, then, the United States would have... hopefully, if Obama's U.N. representative would have been in there, that the vote would have been a lot different. All right, Alicia, I got to move on. Thank you for your comments.
All right, you're welcome.
All right.
Thanks, Alicia.
You have a very good one, and we will talk to you. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here is Jeff in Birmingham. Jeff, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. How you doing, Peter?
Good.
I was listening to you talk a while ago.
Great.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I heard you talk about how you feel we should spread the wealth of people who have hundreds of millions of dollars to the people who don't make so much, and also the economy.
Well, it's not like I'm talking about that they ought to just have a big barrel that people can come and help themselves to. You could you have a distribution of wealth by, you can have taxation programs where that confiscate embedded, impacted wealth. And that would mean, for instance, we could have what I always talk about, have a $50,000 tax deduction. So nobody making, you wouldn't start paying any taxes until you made over $50,000. You could take all that taxes and, like I said, instead of having somebody like the Waltons have, what are they worth, like $65 billion, why don't they just write a check to the auto companies or something like that? We could have a minimum wage of $12 or $13 an hour, and so that's how you spread the wealth.
Yeah, but it's a matter of, you know, people who work hard to get where they're at in this country by, you know, working their tail off and doing what they want to do, and they make it and they make a ton of money. How is it their fault and their problem to make up for the people who are lazy and
wait. How do you figure that the Walton heirs, the heirs to the fortune? You know, maybe you could make that argument with Sam Walton, who started Walmart, but all these people did was to inherit. They don't have any work. They don't run the company. All they do is own it. The CEO makes $23 million, and when someone wants to unionize so they can get $12 an hour, which is what, $24,000 an hour, or a year rather, they close the store. These people are pure evil, pure pathological greed. They don't even use their money in a decent way. Why do I think, Jeff, even though you're from Birmingham, that you would take that money if you had that much, and if people said, we want to make $20 an hour, and you said, let me do the bottom line here, and instead of paying the CEO $23 million, why don't we pay him $2 million a year for the hard work that he does? Because no one can spend $23 million a year. It's just insane that anybody would get that kind of money given to him. And it's really horrible that you would characterize the people that work their tail off at Walmart and an auto plant and McDonald's as lazy, because most of these people that got a lot of this money never did any work. What they did, well, some of them, they invested it.
Right. And I understand that you think that because I live in Birmingham, I'm a rich, you know, person. But, you know, I grew up with a mom who was single, who worked three jobs to try and put us through. And just now, because I'm a successful, I made something of my life. I went to college, took out student loans, worked to pay those off, and now I'm a respectable human being.
Wait.
So money makes you respectable?
Yeah, and that's not the point. Why should a single mother have to work three jobs? Why should you have to have had a debt coming from college? You know why? Because the Waltons got $65 million. And if they and the other people didn't have it, we could live in a society that took care of people. And what a mom you must have. She must be really proud of you, and she must really be probably thinking the sacrifice was worth it. But why should she have to sacrifice in a country that's this wealthy? Okay. No answer. I can imagine that gives you pause. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. And let's see. Here's Jesse. Is in Warren. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hey, you're Jesse. You're on the war. On the air with Peter and Jolene.
How you guys doing tonight?
Doing good.
Good.
All righty. Love your show, man. Been listening to you for about 2 years now, at least.
Oh, great.
Great.
Yeah, we, I just wanted to comment, first of all, I was listening into your guys' comment about Obama possibly not following through there. And, you know, I kind of look at it, I would love it if he does follow through, but I kind of look at it too as we need to kind of get rid of this setup we have going with Democrats versus Republicans. It seems like we kind of need a change in the direction of some new political groups.
Well, I can go for that.
And I think if he doesn't follow through, the Republicans have already pretty much smashed up their chances for a while, then maybe it'll work the same way across the Democratic group we got going now and be a great opportunity for some independent groups to start up.
Well,
have a little bit better of a chance.
You know, I agree with you, actually, Jesse, 100%. The problem is, and I don't have any way to make this happen, is what kind of, I don't know, social mixture or a current or what have you to make that happen? I mean, every once in a while, like, you know, there was a little smattering of a union movement in the 1920s. Then, boom, this huge union movement took off in the 1930s, or there had been for 50 years a lot of agitation for civil rights for African Americans, and then suddenly the 1950s, boom, it just takes off. Well, there's lots of people, Jesse, that feel like you do and like I do, that that there should be some different formulation than Tweedledee and Tweedledummer, being, you know, the latter being Republicans. Yet, even though there's probably millions of us that feel like that, how do we make it happen? Well, I got to tell you, I hope I don't disappoint, but I don't have any big idea on how to make it go around. I just keep yelling for it. I don't know. We need more than talk, though.
Yeah, and along the lines of your guys' abortion subject earlier,
yeah,
it's kind of like that with me, you know, and when it comes to the politics, I find myself rooted democratically. You know, I have grew up with a family of auto workers and city employees. And when it comes to the abortion thing, I kind of find myself more towards responsibility and siding a little bit more with the Republican side. But neither side really gives me a good answer.
I'll tell you, Jesse, that's kind of like being partly pregnant. Here's what
just
we
a
need.
Little bit pregnant.
Yeah, here's what we need. We need an economy that supports families so that women would not, within families, would not want to abort children. That no woman says, oh, this is a good thing to do or a happy event. The other thing is to make contraception available to any woman that wants it so that unwanted pregnancies don't occur. And I think you could, with a situation where you had economic justice, that you could probably reduce, just by that alone, reduce the number of abortions in this country by 75%. A good number of abortions in this country are because of economic reasons. It's just
it's true.
And throughout the world as well. All right. Thank you very much. And the other thing is that it is about the individual woman's choice. I don't think it's accurate to call the anti-abortion compulsory pregnancy people pro-life, but I think it is a good description to call the people that support the right of a woman to choose mm-hmm. herself pro-choice. So don't get in the way of that is my advice as a man, to a man. All right, thank you very much. 313-298-WRIF. Talking about Walmart and the Waltons, where do they get all their money? Walmart said on Tuesday that it would pay at least $352 million and possibly far more to settle lawsuits across the country claiming it forced employees to work off the clock. Several lawyers described it as the largest settlement ever in lawsuits about wage violations. After years of being embarrassed by lawsuits over its wage practices, the company agreed to settle 63 cases pending in federal and state courts in 42 states. Union critics of Walmart, the world's largest retailer, saw the settlement as proof of their view that the company achieves its low prices in part by cheating workers. So,
well, it's about time.
Yeah. So $352 million and the Waltons are worth, actually, I think, I'm trying to remember. Maybe that $65 billion between the five heirs is, but it's between somewhere between $45 and $65 billion. I mean, one of these guys could take $352 million out of his pocket. I mean, these are the people that scammed people making $9 an hour. They didn't want to have to pay them overtime as provided by the wage and hour laws of, for instance, the state of Michigan. That's how low these people are. And in the meantime, they are forcing a price on the products that they buy. This is incredible that that a concern can tell the seller what it wants to pay. So what does a producer in China or Malaysia or someplace like that do? It cuts the wages of its workers in the sweatshops. This is how Walmart gets its money. You know? These, I'll tell you, these people aren't lazy that are running Walmart. They are working every minute of the day. Their little minds are working how they can screw the average person out of more and more money. You say, oh, but they give low prices. Well, they give low prices because they're screwing other people like the people that shop there. It's like that.
I haven't, can't even remember the last time I was, I can't remember if I've ever been in one, actually.
Yeah, go to Costco. That it's the CEO makes several hundred thousand dollars instead of $23 million the way the CEO of Walmart does, and they're unionized as well. All right, 313-298-WRIF. I'm just reading some of these it's just comments here from you who are about to come on the phone. Let's see. Here's Greg. Greg's in Monroe. Hi, Greg. It's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. I want to start off by saying it's the first time I've tuned in. Normally I'm not up this late, but really enjoying the conversation. Some good talk here.
Well, thank you.
One thing I want to comment, and I know the Waltons are an extreme example, and I think we can all agree upon that. But one of the comments you previously made was that these, Sam Walton started the company. Okay, he was entitled to a certain amount of wealth. But the heirs to the fortune, so to speak, what have they done? But to an extent, and I'm still a young man myself, but isn't my understanding is that the goal of every person is to provide a better life, a better opportunity for their kids than they themselves had. And in my own family experience, I know that, and in going from the Walton Temple, my great-grandfather started a company, my grandfather took it over, my father took it over, and each step along the line, each person took risks that could either improve and propel the business or could cause its ultimate downfall. Now, I am not in any way condoning some of these, let's not even call them questionable, but downright dirty practices of the Walmart corporate enterprise, but on a smaller scale, you're talking about the smaller businesses, the mom-and-pop shops, the local businesses that are doing very, very well that were started and created by someone taking a risk that because it's successful, they're doing very well financially.
Yeah, but that's not who we're talking about. I mean, usually when you call those people rich, even, they really turn out to be like upper middle class, that they're making $250,000 or $300,000 a year. We're talking about the ultra rich, the 1% that authentically make up the ruling class, that set the rules of the economy, make decisions that determine whether we go into a depression, whether we have the wages that we deserve, the benefits, and what have you, that are sort of the master class, if you will. So, and it negates democracy. when you have that kind of power that resides in this small little group, it's called an oligarchy, or what they used to call it 100 years ago, a plutocracy, the rule of the rich. So, you know, screw democracy. It's not the rule of the people. It's the wealthy that run everything.
Oh, and I certainly agree. I think you make a very good point there. However, I mean, and the point you're making is one of the ugly points of American politics and the economy. But at the same token, I think it's part of what makes our economy and our democracy so beautiful is the fact that any one person with a great idea, a great invention, a certain level of ambition could create an opportunity to become part of that 1%.
Well, I'll tell you, Greg, the operative word there is could. I mean, you could also get hit by a meteor. The chances of an average person being able to rise above the class from which they are born is pretty limited. I mean, usually people stay in the class that they were born. And I always say this, some poor people become very wealthy, and some wealthy people fall into the gutter. But usually if you're poor, you stay poor. If you're working class, you stay working class. Middle class, you stay middle class. If you're wealthy, there you've got the greatest odds to remain wealthy, because everything is set up in terms of law and custom to maintain the wealth of these families, in many cases, that have had this wealth for generations. I mean, sometimes there's like new little blips, like in technology, so you got a lot of people that start Google and Yahoo and what have you are suddenly millionaires and even billionaires. But the idea that, I mean, this what they used to call the Horatio Alger myth, the rags to riches, is the exception really proves the rule, the fact that it's pretty rare. But look, nobody's talking about taking money away from mom and pop or from a furniture store or something like that. We're talking about concentrated wealth. Nobody needs $65 billion a year. What we need is that money that relieves the pressure on the average family. The people that really work their butts off, not like the guy from Birmingham that talks about lazy people. And that's the deal. The proof is, that's the Calvinism like they used to have in the colonies, that you shall know the elect, those that are going to heaven by their good works. So it's taken for granted if you made a, quote, success for you, of yourself, you're a good person embodying thrift and ambition and all of that. And if you were a mere worker that never got any farther than doing hundreds of thousands of necessary jobs, many of which are not very well respected, and they should be, or very well paid, that you sort of deserve that because you had habits of sloth and no ambition. Well, that's just a myth, and the myth is there to support the idea that the rich rule. One I never accepted. All right, I got to take a break. Thank you for your call. 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. And what's that numerical number?
313-298-9743.
Emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. My website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. We'll be right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. Day nights at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Please stay tuned to the following public announcement. The government and private banks are liquidating houses now. These houses have been foreclosed, confiscated, or repossessed, and will be sold. Homes may be sold for very little money down. To learn how to receive a free list of foreclosures, call 800-354-8211. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N are allowed to start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Every house must be sold. The government and banks are very motivated to sell these homes quickly, so listings may not always remain available in all areas. So act now. I repeat, this is a public announcement. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N can start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Call CRN's national toll-free hotline to learn how to receive your free foreclosure list at 800-354-8211. That's 800-354-8211.
Attention. Hydralyze is currently seeking participants with dark circles and puffy eyes. If you have dark circles or bags around your eyes due to heredity, fatigue, or aging, you are now eligible to try Hydralyze free. Hydralyze was introduced to improve delicate skin around the eyes and now has been shown to eliminate dark circles and bags. It effectively diminishes even dark circles caused by heredity. To participate in the Hydralyze trial and see results risk-free, call 1-800-505-7931. Fragile capillaries around the eye can leak, allowing blood to pool beneath the skin like an ugly bruise. But right now, you can join the thousands of people who have seen their dark circles fade away, watched as bags literally disappeared from view. Participate in the free trial by calling today. If you're serious about getting rid of your dark circles or bags around the eyes, you are eligible to participate and experience a free trial of Hydralyze. For your free trial, call this number today, 1-800-505-7931, 1-800-505-7931.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. Jalene Jordan is with me. President-elect Barack Obama has replaced U.S. President George W. Bush as the most admired man in America.
That wouldn't be tough to do.
Well, but, you know, I think these surveys are phony. If someone came up to you and said, who's the woman you most admire in America? Well, that's what I mean. You went your mind, and so you might say, Laura Bush. That's what a lot of people.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you wouldn't say
that. I would never say that.
Yeah. One-third of the respondents named Obama as their first or second choice, with Bush in second place, but falling to a distant second after 7 years, 5% of the people. I mean, these things don't make any sense. So among men, John McCain ranked third. Three others tied for fourth place. Pope Benedict the 16th, the Reverend Billy Graham, and former President Bill Clinton.
Well, were they in the South there?
I don't know. Hillary Clinton, the most admired woman at 20%. A spot she's held for 13 of the past 16 years. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, a distant second at 11%. Among women, the president-elect's wife, Michelle, came in fifth place, following talk show host Oprah Winfrey in third, and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in fourth. That's pretty interesting. Let me see. Third, fourth, and fifth were African-American women.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that's good. But I think people just don't know what to say.
Who's the
man you most admire in America? Well, my dad. You know, I mean, that's people say, well, I'm going to sound dumb if I say that.
I have to say.
I have a friend of mine who teaches introductory writing classes in Tennessee, and he says that that sort of the standard test, or not test, first writing assignment, was write an essay about the man you admire most, or maybe even the person, and he said almost across the board it was their daddy and their preacher.
Really?
Or their preacher.
Yeah. Okay.
You ever hear George Carlin on the guys talk about my daddy? These guys are 40 years old. They're talking about my daddies. I can't even do the babies. Yo, daddy. Never mind. All the way from Australia, here's Franz. Franz, are you're calling from Australia?
Yeah, that's right. How are you, Peter?
Good. What day is it down there?
Oh, it is Monday.
Yeah. Must be what, in the morning?
No. It's 5 o'clock in the evening.
Oh, my God. I should ask you for the race results for today.
No races on today, mate.
How do you happen to be listening to Night Call on WRIF way down in Australia?
Somehow we got connected, and you put me on the preferred listener site, and I thought I'd give you a call to say thank you.
Oh, well, good. Oh, yeah. Oh, you're Franz. Okay.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've got a good website. Tell us the website. Maybe people will take a look at it.
Oh, thank you. It's vision.org, VUZION.org.
To you Detroiters and people listening in America, that's Z is Z, right?
No, a V for Victor.
Oh, V. Wait a minute. No, but you said Z in there, right?
That was the third letter.
Yeah, I know. So it's V-U-Z, as we say.
Ah, right. Do you?
V-U-Z-I-O.
I-O-N.
Yeah, so it's V like in Victor, U, Z-I-O-N.
That's correct.
Okay, well, that's good. And you do some radio yourself?
I'm a little bit involved in talkback radio with the local ABC here.
Yeah.
Which is the national free-to-air broadcaster. And I've been trying to promote a concept which is, you know, perhaps is known by a lot of people. I can't see a reason why we can't, as a society, adopt a triple bottom line taxation system.
Run that by us again. Your Australian kind of lost us there for a second, Franz. You want to promote a what?
I am trying to promote a triple bottom line taxation system.
Oh, triple a triple bottom line taxation program. Okay. Yeah.
Or a taxation incentive, if you really want to put it that way, because there are a lot of social issues involved in even what America is doing with helping out the banking sector, helping out the car industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that because they keep the banks up and running, the car industry up and running, the industry itself should be able to give something back to society. And for instance, the loans that people might not be able to afford, they could give that back as a social responsibility. Or the car industry could, for instance, make sure that they do produce environmentally friendly cars and what have you.
Yeah, well, for sure. You know, it's interesting, Franz, how people, someone like you in Australia or other people all around the world know so much about American politics and the economy and the social system. And Americans, we are right now sitting 9 miles from the Canadian border, and I'll bet you 80% to 90% of the listeners here don't even know the name of the Prime Minister of Canada. Let alone Australia or...
Well, I wouldn't know the one from Canada, but I know the one from Australia is Kevin Rudd.
Right. Who just recently was elected, right?
He's been in office for just over a year.
Yeah.
And from my perspective, the Australian government is sort of working towards the concept I've just given you.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not being spoken about in real terms. I mean, there's a lot of background work has been taking place towards that objective. But I firmly believe that Australia will implement such a revised, simplified taxation system.
Oh, it'll be good. I mean, here, of course, as you probably know, in the States, it's extraordinary. What city are you calling from in Australia?
I'm actually calling from Melbourne.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we've seen that one on television.
I'm sorry?
I said I've seen that city on television.
Yeah, it's about the second biggest city in Australia, if not the biggest city.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, always looks nice. Well, are you with us?
I still am.
Okay. Well, good. I heard a little click there. But I should move on. So, Franz, thank you for being on our TalkBack program here in Detroit, Michigan.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. And, yeah, your website, V-U-Z-I-O-N. Appreciate you joining us all the way from down under. And something else ran through my brain, but I'm going to have to, I don't know. We'll see if I remember it later. Here is James in Westland. Hey, James, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, dear guys.
Good.
Hey.
It's always great to talk to you. Dick Cheney, in my mind, has committed a war crime. He actually admitted it on ABC, like, I think a week back.
Right, he did.
And, well, I feel that he should be punished for that crime. And for those who don't know, he basically said that he approved waterboarding.
Yeah, as policy. As officially making the United States an outlaw nation by making it a torture state.
Yep. And yeah. Now, back in after World War II, the American Supreme Court actually passed a death sentence on Japanese officials and hung them for waterboarding.
Well, it wasn't, I don't know, they were, the most of the crimes, the Japanese that were hung as war criminals had quite a bit more to their discredit than just waterboarding people.
Yeah, but That was one of the war crimes that they were hung for.
Yeah, that is universally seen, and has been ever since it was devised. They used to call it, there was another name, the water cure. That's what, if you look up, like all of a sudden people are saying waterboarding. I never heard of that. It is a water cure, and it was something that was initially done by the Inquisition back that far in European history of hundreds of years ago. And in modern times, though, it was usually called the water cure and was universally seen as an act of torture that was impermissible under international law and, in fact, under the federal statute. So, indeed, Dick Cheney has confessed publicly to being a war criminal.
So would it be unfair to say that Dick Cheney should be hung for the quote-unquote water cure?
Well, he's all for capital punishment, but I'm not, so we'll leave it at that. But, yeah, do I think that to...
Put him in a cell for a long time.
Yeah, to allow the Bush crime family to get away with the acts that they have of lying about the war, of misfeasance and malfeasance in so many different aspects, of violating the U.S. Constitution, international law, crimes against peace, and to say, oh, we want to move on. Like the Obama officials have. They say, I don't want to get into this thing about prosecuting Bush and Cheney or anything like that because, oh, it would just mire the country and, you know, this controversy and all that. Well, people have committed crimes. It's like saying, I broke into your house, and I would say, well, let's move on, you know, because then my family's going to be mad at your family and what have you. These crimes cannot allow to have been committed without punishment. No capital punishment, though, James. But thank you. I appreciate you bringing that up. Here's something I maybe could get behind. Please note that I'm being facetious. A South Philadelphia man, enraged because a father and son were talking during a Christmas showing of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, took care of the situation when he pulled out a gun and shot the father, according to police. I've been almost at that point.
Yeah?
You know, people yakking in back of you. I mean, it is astounding.
Well, you'll tell him to be quiet, won't you?
Yeah. And then, people, it depends on the situation. I mean, sometimes I've said to people, excuse me, could you discuss the film in either a voice that none of the rest of us can hear or after? And they look either shocked that I asked them that or angry. You know, you say that the guys, you know, like they're...
Right.
Yeah. This is the guy that, you know, like that. I'm saying, I can't believe this.
I know. I watch a lot of movies at home for that very reason. I hate to say it, but I have a friend who can't stand it when people sing along at concerts. Can you imagine that? She tells them to stop. And I went to the Rolling Stones with her, and I looked at her, and I go, I don't think you're going to stop anyone from singing here at all.
Yeah.
She has no tolerance for it.
Well, I mean, you can't hear people singing when the band is playing, can you?
If they're right next to you or right behind you in your ear.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I've been at concerts. You know, people come in. I mean, some of these seats are like $100 they come in late. They go back and forth. They can't sit down for more than 10 minutes, getting beer, you know, coming back. And then they're talking about, I remember this one. You know, if you go to like a classic rock car. And I remember I was at one where this guy kept leaning over and talking to this woman. And every time he leaned over, that was my view.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So.
Very pleasant.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't shoot him.
Well, no, I guess not. Well, but so I asked the guy, I said, you know, every time you lean over like that, I can't see. And he turns around and looks at me. And I'm with this guy that is this black belt in this karate.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And he's just
ready to go.
And he says, you know, I'm trying to enjoy myself here. I said, yeah, I understand that. And I appreciate that. And I'm sorry, I didn't, you know, but can you understand that I can't see? And this friend of mine is edging closer. Like, this guy takes one move for me, you know, the guy is dead. And so I actually kind of stood and I actually moved myself so I'm in front of my friend because I don't want this to, you know, we'll all get thrown out,
yeah,
right? We'll all get arrested.
In jail, right.
Exactly. How do we get off on that?
Well, you read the story.
Yeah. 313-298-WRIF, some open lines if you've been waiting a while. Here's Kyle in Shelby Township. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, how you doing tonight?
Doing good.
I just wanted to make a couple comments on what you were saying about redistribution of wealth. I think the main thing that you're missing is no matter if the highest amount of wealth gain is $100,000, there's still going to be a hierarchical system in place.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, there is in these countries that don't have this enormous disparity of wealth like we do, like in the Scandinavian countries. There still essentially is a ruling class made up of the wealthier people and, you know, that occupy the high social and economic and political strata. But, you know, at least they don't have millions of homeless people, you know?
Okay. And the other point I wanted to make is I know, you know, you guys are very proud of yourself that you're not shopping at Walmart, but you got to understand there's a lot of people that can't make that choice.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, but here's what I'm saying. I think that's worth bringing up that, because I happen to be middle class and there are people that are poor that aren't getting compensated fairly or decently for the hard work that they do. They want to go where there's the lowest prices. And, I mean, I do understand that, but one also ought to understand the whole equation there and why they have low prices and that how it's connected up to poverty in other countries. Okay.
Well, and sometimes if I
appreciate it, Kyle.
I'm broke a lot of the time, believe me. But I would rather go without than go into that Walmart.
Yeah.
Hate to say it.
I don't know. Maybe have people comparison shop between like Costco and Walmart? I think Walmart has a much, much more extensive
inventory
of it. Don't they have food and everything? I think they do.
I think they're
starting to do organic and all
really?
This stuff like that. But there's also Meijer's here in Michigan that, again, is a decent company that's organized.
Yeah, I go there.
Union organized and has union organized workers. So
they have some good prices. And you can get those $4 prescriptions at other places like Kroger, and I think Target has those, Costco as well.
Yeah.
So you don't just, it's not just Walmart.
Roger, who is answering our phones and who we should thank in advance for doing
yes.
the hard work
thank
on
you,
that
Roger.
End. At 313-298-WRIF, he writes, organic food, you name it, to take away all the small, what is this? Oh, he says, Walmart has super centers that have everything, organic food, you name it, to take away all of the small store stuff, even ethnic food. Oh, I see. That's part of this process where it's the mega store. So there's no more mom and pop stores
right.
that our one caller was mentioning
yep.
about. And that's what Walmart does when it goes into communities. So Costco, Meijer's, Walmart shopper, comparison shop for, I mean, I shop so little, it's hard for me even to make a pronouncement. And here from, I don't have the name up on here, but is this Lars from Madison Heights?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Lars. Hi, you're on
hey,
the
Lars.
Air.
Hi, Peter. Hi.
I
was just calling comment. I don't think that a free market's really the proper euphemism for America's economy. I think we have more of a casino economy.
There you go.
Where, you know, the house always wins, the games are rigged, a few people strike it rich, but most people go broke. And it's just, you know, it's like if you don't like it, you can just go to the other casino next door.
Yeah.
Or any other casinos on the strip.
Yep. All right, let's leave it at that because we're almost towards the end of our show. Thank you so much. Let's get a quick word from Maurice in Detroit. Maurice, hi, you're on the air. Give me a quick one.
Hello, Peter. Doing?
Hi,
Maurice.
No, I wanted to say this about the economy. Back in 99 when when Clinton signed the Glass-Steagall bill.
Sure.
Do you get the joke of that? You know, somebody told me to work for the government. Every time they come over their little phrases, you're like Iraqi's freedom. It's a joke behind it. This is what I think the joke is. The eagle is the symbol of America, strong, proud bird, right?
What?
Why would you put... The eagle is a symbol of United.
Oh, right.
Okay, why would you put it in the same sentence as glass? Basically, our economy fractured.
Yeah.
Because I believe it was all done by plan. Because I think it took a while for the banks to get back in line the way it was before 1929, the Great Depression.
Yeah.
And so the ones that got busted got too greedy. You know, they had to bust somebody, you know. All those companies, that, you know, MCA, one of them companies, I think it was MCI, went out of business first. That was the beginning of it.
Well, the greed has sunk us.
Oh, MCI, how could I forget that?
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, it's we had the fox guarding the chicken coop. That's the Bush administration, the Bush crime family.
That's right.
All right, Maurice, thank you very much. Here's John, also our second caller making this program international, John from Windsor. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hello, Peter and Julian. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Hi, John, welcome.
Hi, talking about the distribution of wealth, one thing that always bothers me, I'm a professional truck driver, and I've enjoyed being all over the United States and Canada. The one thing I always come across is people are always saying, oh, you Canadians, you're nice people, but you're socialists. And the bugbear from that is it's always the fact that we have a universal health care system. And usually what happens when somebody says we're socialist, I say, well, do you not pay income tax in the United States of America? And they go, of course we do. I go, well, what do you think that is? That is the collective gathering of wealth from all to distribute to other government projects.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're not any more socialist than Americans are.
Or as much. You know, if you take away the negative connotation, much of which is deserved for what operated under the name of socialism, it simply means socializing a cost. Like, in other words, anytime you drive on a road, I know you know all this, and that cost is socialized, right?
Exactly.
I mean, maybe Bush would like to turn it over to a private firm, but I think that the United States and most other countries, and the biggest socialist project of all at one time was probably the U.S. Highway system, the interstate system.
Yes, the Eisenhower system.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's not trying to throw too many balloons up in the air, but, you know, the $10 billion a month they're spending in Iraq, I'd rather see that, you know, going to the homeless people or the people that are starving in the street and eating out of dumpsters. But that's not going to happen anytime soon because too many people are lining their pockets with gold.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, too, because Obama was elected in a good part because we saw him as representing our desire to end the Iraq war. Well, it's not going to wind down, and there's billions and billions of month, billions and billions a month that are being spent there is going to continue. And how in the world can he be talking about a $700 billion stimulus package above what's already going on? And expand the war in Afghanistan and continue the war in Iraq and not repeal the tax cuts for the wealthy.
Well, and I know the expansion in Afghanistan and Iraq, it brings me back to a Hollywood line from the movie Patton where, you know, nobody died, nobody became a hero dying for their country. You make some other poor son of a bitch die for his country. Well, you know, they've sold everyone, every lost soul we had over there has become a hero, unfortunately. I'd rather see them, you know, doing some good back in the United States of America than dying for a cause that just isn't just.
There you go. Thank you very much, John. Appreciate you calling in. Actually, another listener making our program international, Scott, listening in Stockholm, Sweden. Let me see. Do I have a quick minute to read this? I do. Pardon me. We were talking. It says, Dear Peter and Jolene, you have the best show on radio. Always
fun
to chew on, and it's good for my phone bill that I have that I can listen via podcast. That's very important, right?
Yes. Go to WRIF.com, and you can just find podcasts, and then under Night Call every week, by noon the next day, by noon today, there will be a podcast of the show. So people can listen at their own leisure if they have to get up and work in the morning on Monday.
And unfortunately, I can't read this whole thing, but it's about global warming. And there's more and more on these right-wing sites because we got all of this snow and everything. They say, see, the temperature is going down.
It's
not
just
up.
A big eye roller for me. Yeah. I just can't believe we're even having to deal with this.
And the main point that I always make, I take it for granted that all the climatologists says that there is a climate change.
Yeah.
That it's not about you know, whether we have cold weather and one day and then we had 61 here the other day. Well, oh, see, there's global warming. That's not global warming.
No.
It's the overall patterns. And but even if all those people are wrong, do we still want to keep polluting the atmosphere?
Right.
You got to breathe that crap.
Well, let's talk about all the glaciers that are melting, the countries that are melting. I mean, come on.
They've got an answer for all of that.
I know they do.
Yeah. And I'm not going to take it on. Let's just stop the pollution. That'll do it.
Okay.
That'll settle the argument as well. Well, Julian Jordan, Happy New Year to you.
You too, Peter. Thank you so much. And Happy New Year to everyone.
All our dear listeners. But as we used to say when we left for winter vacation, we were in grade school.
See you next year.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Home of WRIF.com. Get the latest rock news, concert listings, and where Riff is rocking the streets. Check out Motor City's deals and deals and get stuff for half price. Or your 101 The Riff online from anywhere in the world.
Website
worldwide. 101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything rocks.
You're faking it, and it's killing you. You go around wearing a smile, pretending everything's okay. You put up a front to disguise the fact that you're really sick with worry about your health, about your sanity, about everything. And you think nobody understands, but I understand. You're irritable, you lose sleep, and your mind is racing with fearful thoughts. You want it to stop. You just don't know what to do. I'm Lucinda Bassett, founder of the Midwest Center for Stress and Anxiety. I can show you how to make it stop. Please let me send you a powerful free tape that will help you discover a way to stop the painful anxiety and depression without abusing alcohol or taking medication. I did it, and so have hundreds of thousands of people just like you. Start changing your life from the inside out. Please call now.
Call now, and we'll send you this wonderful free tape. Call 800-449-7603. That's 1-800-449-7603. 1-800-449-7603.
Do you know the difference between the millions of millionaires in this country and you? Simple. They decided they wanted to be millionaires, so they went out and did it. So, do you want to be a millionaire? If the answer is yes, then get ready to write down a number that could change your life forever. Because now you can get a free CD that shows you everything you need to start making the kind of money you deserve with an internet business that virtually runs itself. So you're making cash even while you're sleeping by selling products you don't have to see, store, or even pay for. There are millions of millionaires out there. Don't you want to be one of them? Get the free CD from Internet Speedway and start making money with an internet business that virtually runs itself. For your free CD, call 1-800-339-1419. Deciding to be wealthy is the first step to becoming wealthy. Call now, 1-800-339-1419. The free CD is yours by calling 1-800-339-1419.
Blocks of your favorite riff rock.
Just a little more.
Along with extra 90s blocks all weekend long.
Plus,
keep it locked in a riff all weekend long. For your chance to score tickets to see Hinder with special guest Trav and Rep Theory. December 19th at Clutch Cargo's. The 90s Block Party Weekend.
Listen and win.
101 WRIF. Everything.
Woo!
That rocks. 101 WRIF. WRIF HD1 Detroit. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. One element that seemed to be with us so strongly in the run-up to the 2008 elections was the question of Iran. Was it arming itself with nuclear weapons? Was it planning aggressive actions? Was it, quote, meddling in Iraq? And we were fortunate last March, that's March 2007, to get a first-hand impression of the country. Rudy Simons, a Detroiter, was on a delegation. He shared his information, the people he spoke with, and he's gone again. And he's back to talk to us once again about a trip he took at the end of November to December 7th. Rudy Simons went with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and it was a delegation, an interfaith delegation to Iran. And I'm anxious to find out what he found out. And in the studio with me, Rudy Simons, thanks for joining me again on the Peter Werby Show.
Nice to be with you again, Peter.
So, you went, why a second trip? I mean, I went to Cuba twice, so it's an odd, I liked going to Cuba. Did you go, well, tell me the motivation for your trip.
Yes, well, there's always a great deal more to be learned with the second trip, and I presume as well with the third and the fourth, things you did not see or didn't hear or didn't remember or didn't understand the first time around. It's like seeing a good film the second time when you uncover all sorts of layers that were not apparent to you the first time.
But now we think of Iran as this militant Islamic country that would not be very welcoming to an interfaith delegation, which I would imagine would be Christians, Jews, and Muslims. Was that who were the participants in the delegation to Iran?
Well, it was intended to be, but at the last minute of the original 18, four were scratched by the authorities in Tehran. We don't know why. They don't give reasons. And among those four were two Muslims, one of whom was an imam, and one American rabbi, and a fourth person whom I cannot otherwise identify. But the 14 of us were an unusual group in that we were Jewish and Christian, but majority Jewish, 10 out of the 14, unheard of in going to Iran.
I would think so. I mean, what the impression we get, the statements that come out of Tehran and the Iranian government, Jews are thought of in a very low regard and hostility to the country of Israel. And go ahead.
Americans, by and large, I have learned through the last couple of years, know very little about Iran, and most of what we know is wrong. So this is an opportunity to go and see with one's own eyes and to listen with one's own ears and to talk to scores of people, hundreds of people, collectively perhaps even 1,000 people over a period of a couple of weeks in direct formal meetings and in the most informal kinds of casual meetings on the street and in the parks and at the gardens and so forth.
Well, my interest was Jewish Americans going to a country that professes a hostility, at least officially, to Jews and to Israel. Or is that a misreading?
It's a complex subject. The Jews with whom we met, and we met with major members of the Jewish community in both Tehran and in the beautiful city of Shiraz, much further south, spoke to us at length about their position within the community. You know that Iran, or Persia as it was once called, is the longest continuous Jewish community in the world, and the Jews of Iran today are very proud of knowing that they are part of that. By and large, they seem to be living reasonably comfortable and successful lives. They attended their synagogues with great enthusiasm and packed the place. We went to services the first Friday night we were in Tehran, and while we got there early and saw only a scattering of people and thought, well, is that what this community is like here? By the time the services had been 5 or 10 minutes along, the place was packed with 500 members of the local Jewish community, which numbers somewhere between 7,000 and 8,000 people and has its own school system, has a hospital it sponsors, and so forth. So it has community services and a well-organized and seemingly contented Jewish community in Tehran and in Shiraz.
So this is not a community at risk?
It does not appear to be so.
You know, one thing, and I bet I asked you this when we spoke about your trip to Iran, Rudy Simons, in March of 2007. I remember there was a group in the United States during the 1930s called the Soviet American Friendship League. And they took people to the Soviet Union, people, and I thought about this during my trip to Cuba, because I, in many ways, had kind of an official tour. Now, it wasn't a government tour or anything like that, but I had the same impressions. Everyone seemed happy, and a lot of people we spoke to were all very enthusiastic about the revolution, all the while realizing that there are a lot of critics, both among just the average person and the official sort of dissidents. But I was always, had like a little, what would you say, a little reservation about accepting everything I was told, because people went to the Soviet Union, said it was a workers' paradise, there was workers' democracy, and of course we know it was this hideous Stalinist dictatorship.
Iran is exactly the same thing. I'm a skeptic, and make no mistake about it, the government is both church and state, as we would say in this country. In the embodiment of a single individual, a grand Ayatollah, named Khomeini, and the Islamic faith is the government, is the faith. It is repressive, it is restrictive, and we were certainly not blind to those kinds of restrictions. It's the kind of society that you and I would feel hogtied in many ways.
We probably would be hogtied. Literally.
But one has to see beyond that. Iran is a very large country. It's about three times the size of Iraq, with about three times the population, twice the size of Texas. It's a highly developed society, cultured, educated, devoted to many things, not least of all the arts. There is not an Iranian you can find beyond the age of maybe eight who cannot willingly recite the lines of the famous Persian poets going back to the 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th century, whose tombs are in garden settings and celebrated throughout the country. There's much to admire in Iranian society, but not the government and the way it is run, as far as we are concerned.
Yeah, I guess I feel the same way about the Cuban government.
Sure.
Yeah. Rudy Simons is my guest. He was a participant in an interfaith delegation to Iran at the end of November and the beginning of December. It was organized by the Fellowship of Reconciliation. You can go to FOR.org, and that's a long-standing interreligious pacifist group, is that?
It's almost 100 years old. It started in connection with the first shots of World War I. It started in 1914 in Europe. It has developed through the years. It's now based in 44 countries around the globe, though not any of the Islamic countries, although they hope to remedy that. The aim of this particular delegation, for the first time among the eight delegations that FOR has taken to Iran, was to carry on an interreligious dialogue. And indeed, we did do that, not only with the Jewish community, but with the Christian community, which is headed by an archbishop with whom we met. It's an Armenian church. All the Christians in Iran are part of that church, the Eastern Rite. And we met with, among other clerics, we met with a very high-ranked and highly regarded Ayatollah, who gave us several hours and is considered very much in the liberal camp in Iran. That would surprise a lot of people. Ayatollahs, well, they're all going around with whips.
Well, this surprises me, yes.
Yes, and there is a very keen and clear separation between what this person believes and what that person believes, and they're all part of the mix. It is not all one way, and you either believe this way and act this way or get out.
Well, Rudy Simon, you were there for almost 2 weeks, and you said you met with different religious leaders, and that obviously didn't fill the whole days. What were some of the days like, or the ones that stand out the most to you?
Well, while we were in Tehran, they were mostly meetings of one sort or another. We met with something, for instance, called the Center for Interreligious Dialogue. We met with a prominent author and critic of the government, and a fierce pacifist who served all 8 years in the Iran-Iraq War, who has written novels and written some letters, political letters, that are widely known throughout the country, and who is involved in filmmaking. And we saw one of his films, which dealt with the eight-year war and his own participation in it. It was a wonderful film. We met with people who are involved in the arts and education through a separate institution. So our day was filled with meetings, particularly in Tehran. It was a lot more touristic as we moved further south, but indeed we had many meetings there as well in Isfahan and in Shiraz.
What people stood out in your mind? Who was, had an impact on you that you remember strongly?
Well, I would remember strongly several people. One was the Ayatollah that I had mentioned earlier. Another was this writer who had a very strong and engaging personality, and one could see his devotion to trying to set forth the idea that wars are neither necessary nor profitable for anybody. Those two, perhaps, and the services in the Jewish synagogue in Tehran with their very spirited sort of rituals. It was entirely different experience than I had with the first delegation. Every single meeting was with a different group than we had met with in all of our meetings the first time around. So you start peeling off some layers, and you get to look a little deeper into what that society is like.
Everything you're sketching out here, of course, is almost 180 degrees opposite to what most of us receive through the mainstream media here in the United States. And it's almost solely political here, that we have a country antagonistic to the United States and to Israel. The president, Ahmadinejad, just said that Jesus, I don't know if you saw this, Jesus would have opposed the United States. That's his Christmas message he's going to broadcast in the United Kingdom. That they're developing nuclear weapons, that they're meddling in, or they're committing mischief in Iraq.
Let me speak to that briefly. Each country, Iran and the United States, has its own narrative about the other country. And it's important to exchange those narratives so that they understand our concerns and so that we in the United States begin to understand theirs. When I talk about our concerns with them, you have mentioned them. The meddling in Iraq, the takeover of the U.S. Embassy in 1979. I'm trying to think of the support that they have for Hezbollah and Hamas. But their narrative is entirely different. It has to do with the United States, jointly with Britain, overthrowing their clearly elected and revered Prime Minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, in 1953. With the United States backing Saddam Hussein, something most Americans either don't know or have ignored, during the time of that 8-year war, which was started by Saddam with attacks on Iran and included the use on many, many occasions of chemical weapons, which were supplied in part by the United States, although not by the United States alone, and so forth.
And the United States was very pleased that the two countries were fighting, as a matter of fact.
Oh, indeed. Yeah. Yes, as we were happy to see Germany and the Soviet Union killing each other off during the period of World War II.
Yeah. Actually, Harry Truman made that statement in 1940 in the United States Senate. He was very pleased that they would be blooding each other. And the United States gave intelligence information to Saddam Hussein to assist carry on the war.
And equipment, important material at that time.
I suppose, I don't know, going to Tehran wouldn't give you any more information about whether or not Iran is trying to develop nuclear weapons, but
no.
Any observations?
Yes, the story is, and it is one which is unanimous, that Iran is entitled to have nuclear energy, and indeed it is, according to the terms of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, of which Iran is a signatory, that they are entitled to have that nuclear energy, but not nuclear weapons. They cite the fact that Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979, the year of the revolution, issued a fatwa, an order, saying that Iran does not now and will never have nuclear weapons. They are un-Islamic, and that is cited to us time and time again. Whether you want to bet your life on it is something else.
I was going to say, how we make that determination, those are pieces of it. I don't believe, and I say obviously to the listeners, if they've been listening to this show, and I suspect you as well, Rudy Simons, don't think that nuclear weapons should be, there should be any more nuclear powers in the world, and they shouldn't be developing nuclear power either.
Well, that is an open question. I'm very skeptical about the nuclear power issue, but it is at least allowable under the terms
right.
of the treaty. I think that if Americans want to be scared about something, they ought to take a look at Pakistan
sure.
with an unstable government and already developed and demonstrated nuclear weapons. I think that's far more dangerous to us and to the world at large. And if there's going to be a nuclear disarmament, let it start at home.
Yeah, yeah. In March of 2007, I asked you, and again, I didn't think you had any particular information, having visited Iran at that time, whether or not the United States was going to invade Iran or bomb Iran to attempt to destroy its nuclear facilities. That actually has sort of dropped off the map, hasn't it?
Not with the Iranians. They are still concerned about that, and I think they have reason to be concerned, though from my perspective, I think it is far less likely now than I would have thought at the time of my first trip 20 months earlier.
Yeah, and also there's talk of Israel doing the dirty work.
Yes, and there is the same mindset among a group of people in both Israel and the United States that wants to get on with it and start dropping those bombs.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little about the meddling in Iraq? I just learned through the New York Times that there's actually a base in Baghdad that has almost the amenities of the Green Zone, where Iranian guerrillas, terrorists are housed and undertake operations going into Iran. So it seems like the United States, quite far from home, is meddling in Iran.
Oh, the United States has boasted about the fact that they have many agents in Iran placed in areas where there are non-Shia populations, particularly among the Kurds and the Armenians. It's ironic. There are two groups of Kurds in the north that are seeking independence and want to have their own state, as they have had for a very long time. One group, the NPK, I forget for the moment, is fighting against Turkey, and the United States is siding with Turkey in fighting that group of guerrillas, Kurdish guerrillas. But on the other side, further to the east, where the Kurds coincide with their Kurdish brethren inside of Iran, the United States is doing what it can to arm and encourage that group of Kurdish rebels because Turkey's a friend and Iran isn't. So there's no consistency from a moral standpoint, though there may be, obviously, for tactical and strategic reasons.
And the United States, quite far from home, is fighting a war on the western and eastern border of Iran. If some foreign power was fighting a war in Mexico and Canada, it would concern us.
Exactly right. If some unknown country, named, for instance, China, invaded Canada, does anybody think that the United States would not do what it could to support the Canadians in resisting that kind of an invasion? Well, the Iraqi people are overwhelmingly, or at least in a majority, a good solid majority, Shia in Iraq, and they are brothers and sisters to the people of Iran and have gone back and forth for centuries. And Iraq, of course, was part of the Persian Empire, as was Afghanistan and so forth.
We only have a few minutes left with Rudy Simons, who was on a trip just recently to Iran with the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Again, that's FOR.org. And it will also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And let's just speak in the minutes remaining about the trip and the impressions you had. Are Iranians fearful that they're going to be attacked by either the United States or Israel?
I didn't hear as much conversation about that this time around as I did before. Whether or not that's because of circumstances which are unrelated to anything else but our travel arrangements, or because they see a new day coming in the United States, and they're very aware people. They read the newspapers. They know what's going on elsewhere in the world, and they know there's a new administration coming to the United States. And so I think perhaps there is an easing of tension, But that's a surmise, and I can't state that as a fact.
Well, there was intense joy expressed all over the world outside of the United States upon the election of Barack Obama. Was there any enthusiasm for his presidency?
I tried very hard to inject that discussion into the interreligious discussions we were having, and by and large, our hosts would have none of it.
I'm not sure what you mean.
What I mean is they did not care to discuss the American political situation.
Okay, and were you able to meet just ordinary Iranians?
Oh, many, many.
And did they express any opinion about Barack Obama?
Yes. They were happy, at least, that the current administrators would no longer be present. How much they know about Mr. Obama and what his intentions are is hard to say. But they know that they did not like and do not like our present administration, and they expressed that countless times to us on both trips.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning, Rudy Simons, you said the second trip, and you said you would learn even more on a third and fourth trip. What's the impulse to go back?
Well, of course, I don't want to do that tomorrow, and I can't afford that either. But I have an intense interest in that country built up over these two journeys and an immense amount of reading and study. And I would like to deepen my understanding of the country, though there are many other places that require America's attention as well. So,
well, you've actually, and we've had discussions over the years. Let me try to remember: Colombia, Iraq,
Iraq, Haiti, Israel, and Palestine. Yes.
Yeah. And what's next on your list?
Well, I want to be home more than just in time to change my laundry. I've got a young son growing up here, and so I have to pick my spots where I can.
It's very unusual that an American, a Jewish American particularly, could go to a country like that with everything involved. And so most of us are going to be listening to these reports that you've given that are extraordinarily important to hear. But is there any, like, advice you would give to someone? Because, like, I'm sure there's at least a few heads out there being scratched, thinking, whoa, I thought they were our implacable enemies. I thought they hated everybody. I thought that they would, there'd be pogroms going on there.
Well, let me just say in a blanket statement that I have never seen a group of Americans more warmly received with expressions of admiration and even love than I saw in Iran. And that's something Americans should have some idea about, and they're not likely to get it very often from the general media here, because we don't have people in Iran, and the same words get said again and again without much background connected to it. Yes, read and listen where you can. Listen to the BBC, which has people in Iran. Listen to the CBC, which also has connections with Iran. And read those kinds of journals that are a little more thorough in their analysis, both for better and for worse.
Well, and in a way, that's such an indictment of our media, but I agree 100%.
Well, there are exceptions.
Yes. There's a radio show that I know of. Rudy Simons, as usual, thanks for being my guest. Rudy Simons was a participant in an interfaith delegation to Iran at the end of November through the beginning of December, and he went with the Fellowship of Reconciliation. You can go to FOR.org, my website as well, peterwerby.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Listen to score tickets for Motley Crue, February 13th at Grand Rapids, along with a spot on a WRIF Love This Party bus for the show. Bring in the Julia for the riff. Get details now at WRIF.com from 101 WRIF. The Riff.
All right, $9 million. taxpayers, all of you who have stuck with me.
Divided by 900,000 citizens.
Through very difficult times.
$10 a head. Now, you're not getting much more out of these guys.
I'm sorry.
Good thing you can still text message us at the RIM. Get your request, concert info, and your unfair cellular advantage. Text keyword WRIF to 71913. And,
I'm sorry.
We'll never be embarrassed to hear from you.
I would never quit on you.
Log on to WRIF.com for more details. 101 WRIF.
My phone blowing up.
The
Do you know the fastest way to learn a new language?
Memorization?
We always did translation.
Is it drills?
The world's fastest, easiest way to learn a new language is Rosetta Stone software. It doesn't waste your time with tedious translation, useless memorization, or boring drills. Instead, it teaches you a new language the same way you learned your first language. And right now, you can experience it for yourself because Rosetta Stone is offering a free demo CD-ROM. Check out the easiest, fastest way to learn the language of your choice. For the free CD-ROM, call 1-800-441-6151. Discover what U.S. diplomats, NASA, and over 10,000 schools already know, that this is the world's fastest, easiest way to learn a language, guaranteed. Choose from 31 languages and request your free CD-ROM today. You'll be amazed at what you learn. Just call 1-800-441-6151. Request your free CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone by calling 1-800-441-6151. That's 1-800-441-6151.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I can't begin to count how many times we've talked about the war in Iraq and its occupation over the last, what is it now, 7 going on 8 years. And I look for ways that we can continue having this in our consciousness, because people are still dying, lives are still being disrupted, refugees are still being created, infrastructures are being destroyed, suicide bombers continue. So even though with what we're facing economically, the war, although in its most ferocious stages, has tamped down considerably, it still continues. So this is a book by an author that approaches this from, I think you will agree when we begin our conversation, that is extraordinarily unique. Well, who I'm going to be interviewing is Iraqi-born artist Wafa Bilal, and he is right now a professor, an assistant professor at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, and he has exhibited his artwork worldwide, including Baghdad, but also the Netherlands, Thailand, Croatia, as well as the Museum of Contemporary Photography in Chicago, the Milwaukee Art Museum, and considerable number of other places as well. His book is called Shoot in Iraqi: Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Sun, and it's written with Carrie Leiterson. And we welcome Wafa Bilal from his home in New York City. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks a lot, Peter. It is really a pleasure to be on your show.
Now, this is such an extraordinary story, and rather than getting right into what the title refers to, Shoot in Iraqi, let's just get a little of your personal history, because you were born in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, and you've been here. You've come to the United States in 1992. You're an American citizen, so you've been here a very long time. But tell us some of your childhood and where you were raised and the circumstances of how you got to the United States.
I was born in the holy city of Najaf. That's a holy Shia center for the entire world, and it's about 80 kilometers south of Baghdad, and in 1966. And that was just a few years before the Ba'ath Revolution. And when I grew up under the regime of Saddam Hussein. Basically, one of the just kids who idolized the Ba'ath Party and didn't see the danger that is behind Saddam and his regime.
Mm-hmm. Let me just interrupt to tell people that that you're talking about the Ba'ath Party, B-A-A-T-H, and it was Saddam Hussein's party.
Yes.
And it was a totalitarian party in that it totalized all political thought and a lot of cultural thought, right?
Very much so, and I may add also that the regime, Saddam's regime and the Ba'ath Party, were brought to Iraq by the CIA in the early 60s, and it continued, the CIA and the United States continued to support the regime until it toppled in 2003. But going back to the childhood, very much idolized the regime, idolized Saddam, and idolized the party as well. But growing up and see how the regime of Saddam is personally dismantle any democratic infrastructure and become a totalitarian regime that it only serve one man, and any person that opposed him will be eliminated, and sometimes in a brutal way as and graphic way by tying him to the nearest pole and shoot him.
Hmm.
So I early on...
Did you actually see any of that? Were you aware personally of how brutal and oppressive Saddam Hussein was?
As a kid, no. I mean, kid growing up, Saddam's tried to replace the allegiance of the family, of the tribe, to the allegiance to the state. And he was very successful. As kids, he take us kids and open art centers, a youth center, supply us with anything. And that was part of the plan, is to gain our trust. And in fact, it got to the point when kids start reporting on their dads and family members that's been the family members being against the state. And then in the 80s, things start changing. Before the 80s, before 1880 war with Iran, Saddam had very good control over Iraq. And in 1980, Saddam decided to attack Iran and topple the regime of Khomeini, which is it's just a very young regime, took over Iran in the revolution in 1997. And from that point, we start seeing bodies arise to Najaf and the holy city. A lot of Shiite are buried in Najaf. And we saw the regime becoming more and more brutal in his effort to win the war, an effort to send the young Iraqis to the front line. Then the money started rolling from the art centers, and we start opening our mind to how, to the direction that Saddam was taking the country, and how families are losing just members on a daily basis.
Wasn't there about, I think, a million soldiers died during the Iran-Iraq war of the 1980s? I mean, it was just a slaughter that the United States has never even faced.
Very true. I mean, 1 million people on both sides, on the Iraqi side and on the Iranian side. And imagine the country was about 13 million people at the time. Imagine losing 1 million people over the period of 8 years, from 1980 to 88.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a very big impact on Iraqi and devastated the Iraqis, but also brought the wars of the regime. And he starts capturing people on the street and sending them to the front line. And if people are opposed to that, go on to the front line, they will be captured and executed, sometime publicly.
Did you have family members that were involved in the fighting?
In the front line, I had my brother for a long period of time. And I have one of my cousins that was executed for being accused of belonging to another party. And that was the turning point for me when I saw how my cousin was just unjustifiably executed. I very much woke up and I start just opposing to the regime.
Let me reintroduce you as well. My guest is Wafaa Bilal. He is an Iraqi-American. He's been here since 1992. He teaches art. in New York City, and his book published by City Lights is Shoot an Iraqi, Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Gun. And we'll get to the extraordinary part that Art plays in this story in just a little while. Wafa, are you from a Shiite background?
My family, yeah. I am a Shiite. I grew up in the holy city of Najaf and most of the south of Iraq and big part of Baghdad are Shiite. So Saddam's, in particular, oppressed the Shiite in Iraq because he's from a Sunni background and Iran is mostly Shiite. So he was from the very beginning fighting the Shiite, and the Shiite never submit to his rule, and they always fought him. Politically and sometimes military within inside Iraq, but he was very afraid of the alliance of the Shiite of Iran and Shiite of Iraq, and that was part of why he attacked Iran right away after Khomeini took over.
Mm. Now, in 1979, when Khomeini took over, exactly. And then the war began in 1980. You talk in your book, Shoot an Iraqi, that you were forced to flee in the chaotic aftermath of the first Gulf War. What were the circumstances that drove you out of the country?
Yeah, well, this bring back to us to my days in college. And what happened is when I finished high school, I applied to art school, and that was one of my dreams as a kid to finish to go to art school to the Academy of Baghdad. And when I applied, I was rejected because of the executed cousin, and then I was sent to study geology and geography at the University of Baghdad. Through the years, about 5 years at the university, I produced an art show that was critical of the regime in a direct way or indirect way. And as a consequence, sometimes the show will be closed permanently. Sometimes the show will be confiscated. And every time I have a show, I will be dragged to the security office at the University of Baghdad. And in 1990, when the regime invaded Kuwait, I was in last year of college at the University of Baghdad, and the regime come and to ask us to volunteer to go to war, and I was one of the people who are publicly refused to do such a thing, and I know my days were numbered at that time, and I was on the run. So I left Baghdad to Najaf, and from Najaf, when I got there, the war started. The United States started bombing, and the Allies started bombing to free Kuwait. And that lasted about 40 days or so. But right after that, the uprising took place in Iraq against the Saddam regime.
This was in the south where the Shiites... They initially were pretty much encouraged to do so.
Well, very much so.
Yeah, by George Bush the First.
That's exactly it. And when he basically he gave a televised speech to the entire Iraqi nation and asking them to rebel against Saddam, and the United States will help them. And in fact, it was on the contrary. We were very surprised to see George Bush the senior helping Saddam to quell the uprising instead of helping people. So I basically was cornered because Saddam starts, after the uprising and people capture the city, Saddam start moving from Baghdad to all the way to Basra to capture the cities back, and he brutally bombed them with every weapon he can use under the watch of United States. And I was moving ahead of the military one city by one until I got to Kuwait. And in Kuwait, I crossed the border against the will of Kuwaitis, and I was arrested. But luckily, I was let out and stayed on the border for another 40 days when later we were under the protection of United States Army, and later we were transferred to refugee camps in Saudi Arabia, one is spent 2 years there.
And then you, in fact, I'm finding this fascinating because we just look at the bigger picture, and when we hear how the war there affected people directly, yeah. It takes on a different character to it. The book is Shoot an Iraqi, Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Sun. My guest is Wafa Bilal, and also writing the book along with him, Carrie Leiterson. Let's do this, because I want to hear more of this, but I also want to get people up to the subtitle of Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Gun. Now, you came here in 1992. You became an American citizen, an artist whose works have been shown all over the world. And then suddenly, you realize that in Iraq, during the 90s, there's this blockade by the United States that's causing all sorts of deaths there of Iraqi people. And then by 2002, there's the war again, is in the shadows of war return. And yet your family was all in Iraq, right?
Very much so. I mean, I left Iraq. I was running, and the only other person, my brother, who in fact lives in Detroit right now. But the entire family left in Iraq, and one thing many people didn't know, that after the war ended in 1991, there was an embargo, a blockade against Iraq that lasted almost 10 years. And maybe more 10 years, and other consequences, 1.5 million Iraqi lost their life because of that, and mostly kids and older. And and the family, my immediate family, were impacted very strong, and we lost my grandfather, my grandmother, due to very simple thing. Because they cannot afford buying simple medication. And then we lost one thing that is very important. Just our childhood memories revolve around the place we grew up, our grandfather's home. And the family were forced to sell it for nothing just so they could survive for a few months.
So you are living in the safety and comfort of the United States, and here your relatives back in the old country, as we used to call it, are suffering this great travail. What were your emotions about, at this period?
The emotion was very high, and I think being an artist helped me a lot to deal with this duality, just because being here, and you see there is just a great injustice being done to the Iraqi people. In fact, the embargo never affected Saddam because it made him even stronger. And in fact, some of Bush's administration, like Dick Cheney, was dealing with him directly buying the oil, or indirectly sometimes. So what I did through the 90s, I focused my effort in exposing how the embargo hurting the Iraqi people by building shows, by going on the road for speaking tours, just to, one, to raise awareness, and I saw that is a great deal since I'm here in the United States. If anything could change, it has to come from the people. And that's why I have so much faith in the people to change the status quo. Mm-hmm. And instead of being against the people of the United States, I saw them as a victim as well of this political machine of the government. And I very much start connecting with people through my art show. I start connecting to people by talking to them, going from one state to another to raise awareness of the embargo. And then the war, or just the drums of a new war against Iraq, we start hearing in 2002 and early 2003, and I couldn't even believe it. We're going to go to another war with Iraq.
And then it occurred, and again, civilians are being killed, and your own brother was killed in Iraq by a U.S. bomb, and not by a human being, but by an unmanned predator drone. Tell us what you discovered after this terrible event occurred, that about what you saw about
yeah.
The, yeah.
Well, in 2003, I was one of the few Iraqis who opposed the war, Iraqis in the United States opposing the war, because what I saw just the people going to be affected, not Saddam's regime. And I opposed it from the very beginning, and I know there are going to be great losses and by turning Iraq to a war zone. So in 2004, unfortunately, I received the news that is one of my brothers was killed in Iraq, and at the beginning I didn't get the details from the family how he was killed, but then I learned he was on the street when a drone plane scoped the city, and then an air to service missile come to where he was standing in a checkpoint and killed him instantly.
And this, you watched a TV interview and found out that a young U.S. soldier whose job it was to launch missiles into Iraq from a computer in Colorado had been the one that had pushed the button. And
Very much so. So from 2004, and I have to say 2 months later, we lost my father because he was grieving, and he couldn't handle the shock of losing his son all of a sudden. So we lost him 2 months later. But I continue to think how I could connect these two zones together, the comfortable zone here, which I live in, and there the war zone, the conflict zone.
So we get actually now to the title of your book, which we've been holding people in suspense now for almost 20 minutes.
Yes.
We just have a few minutes left, so we should probably go directly to that. The book is Shoot an Iraqi, Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Sun, Wafa Bilal and Carrie Leiterson. And you did essentially an art installation, Domestic Tension.
Yes.
And that's where the title Shoot an Iraqi. Tell us
exactly,
about that.
Exactly. So in 2007, I was watching the news when I saw an interview with a soldier that's directing drone planes and dropping missiles on Iraq, and when she was asked by the reporter if she has any remorse on people's lives, she said, no, I trust the order of my superiors. And it really shocked me how we become disconnected even by targeting other people in other countries. And that's when the idea come, and the idea was I wanted to demonstrate how we are disconnected. So what I did, I moved my living space to a gallery space. I built a robot that shoot paintball at me, and I stayed in the gallery for 30 days. During that 30 days, I had people from 136 countries shooting at me with 80 million hits on the website, and 65,000 times I was shot at. I never left the gallery space, and during that time, I was constantly talking to people on a chat room, which is where they could see me and talk to me 24 hours, 7 days a week for 30 days.
Let me just summarize this. So you set up an installation, essentially, that people, by just a mouse click, could shoot you with a paintball. You were shot 60,000 times. Your site had millions of hits to it. And what did you think about the fact, did it hurt when you got hit by a paintball?
It does. I mean, anybody who play paintball, it just really hurt. And these guns are designed to shoot from 200 feet, and the gun was about 20 feet from me. It hurt a lot, but also I learned a great deal about myself, my people, and how to deal with the losses as well. I deny I lost my brother, I lost my father, until I was emotionally and physically exhausted in the project, and I finally admit the losses. But I think the most thing that fascinates me is just how the platform become a place for people to express their thoughts. people to connect to each other, people to talk about issues like war, and many of us here in the comfortable zone are reluctant to talk about it. And all of a sudden, you see this side that you could shoot somebody and all the traffic coming in. But then you encounter this is not just a playful game. This is really human being is being shot at.
Yeah, were you shocked that you were shot at so many times with the paintballs?
Yes.
Yeah, and I see from your book, Shoot an Iraqi, that some of the what was said in the chat room was also pretty shocking, pretty racist,
very
pretty
brutal,
mean.
Very yeah. race. I mean, it's very brutal, and I think that's the nature of being disconnected. It's just because we part of it is we demonize others because we are. And aware of that culture. And I think the website demonstrate, the chat room demonstrate that very well by bringing the brutality in people to express themselves. And there are just brutal moments, but there are also wonderful moments happen there when a group of people decide to establish the virtual human shield, and for many days they start defending me by taking the gun and aiming it to the left side, so preventing other people from shooting directly at me.
Oh, there is hope.
Of course, and I think that's what we have to believe in, because that's the only thing left to us, hope, and also we have to be determined to gain our freedom, not only freedom, but we have to be determined to ask for justice to other countries as well.
Well, you know, we're almost out of time completely, and I would leave you with the last word, Wafa Bilal. It looks like things are beginning to come to the end of this seemingly endless war, an occupation that the United States launched, all on the basis of lies, of course. Is there hope for Iraq, in your estimation?
Peter, there is hope for Iraq and hope for the United States, but I'm really, now, after I left the pinball project, the domestic tension, I was faced with a post-traumatic stress disorder, and that's what my fear is. What happened when 150,000 soldiers gonna come back home? One, we have to be aware of their post-traumatic experience, but also we have to be aware that we never go to another war without knowing the fact, and we should never let any government drive us to dark places, and at the end we and the rest of the world gonna lose.
Well, thank you so much. My guest has been Wafa Bilal. You can go to his website and see much more of all of this. Wafaa is the first name, Bilal.com. If you missed that, you can either go to City Lights, that's the publisher, citylights.com, or my website where I'll have a link, Peter Werbe, Werbe.com. The book is Shoot an Iraqi, Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Sun. Wafa Bilal and Carrie Leiterson are the authors. Thank you so much for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. 101 WRIF.
You're my hero. Everything that rocks.